You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints for the week of October 7th, 2016. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we bring you a discussion on the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew, which tore through Haiti. Later in the show, we feature our recent interview with Puerto Rican Jewish feminist, poet, author, and activist Aurora Levins Morales. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Tuesday's program with guest host and senior producer Kevin Pina on Haiti and the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew.
This first half hour we're going to devote to Hurricane Matthew, which just struck the island nation of Haiti. At least 11 people have been killed so far. The number is mounting as we understand. There's also growing fear of waterborne diseases. And guess what that number one waterborne disease is? It is cholera. It is cholera that was brought by the United Nations, who has yet to acknowledge and give damages to the victims. Only recently did they acknowledge, actually, that they had brought cholera to the island, but they have yet to actually really own up to it. And also now we hear that there are two warships the United States has dispatched to the island nation, and at least 300 U.S. Marines are part of that contingent. Now joining me from Haiti is our good friend Yvonne Kenny-san. Yvonne, welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Kevin, and thanks to your listening audience. I know they are very worried about us, and we appreciate it.
Well, we're all very anxious. We're all very anxious to hear about the effects of Hurricane Matthew. I have a lot of questions for you, but let's start first with the strength of Hurricane Matthew and the devastation that it left in its wake.
Well, Kevin, the entire southern peninsula is underwater. Flooding is a big thing in cities like Cai, Port-Salut. The entire coast is underwater. Jacmel, the same thing. Bene, same problem. Jeremy is totally flooded. The city of Pistel, this is where Gifilid is, totally flooded. So it's devastating. And I think postponing the election is a wise decision, because you cannot have election when four of our what you would call states are not going to be able to participate.
I understand that some of the presidential candidates have actually been participating in relief efforts. We heard a report that Jovenel Moise, for example, has flown 9 truckloads of rice into Grand Anse in order to support relief efforts there. I also understand that Fami Labalas and Dr. Maurice Narcisse has organized medical teams through UNIFA, the University of the Aristide Foundation, doctors and nurses, as well as other people who are involved in relief efforts there. Can you talk a little bit about that, please? Oops, did we lose Yvonne? Yvonne, can you hear me? Well, we seem to be having a slight technical problem. Let me bring on our next guest. I have also in studio with me Walter Riley. Walter is with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Well, Walter, we all have to be very concerned not only about the human situation, the situation of people's safety and the outcome of this devastation, but also the political situation as well. Well, why don't we talk a little bit first about the response of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund to this disaster?
Well, the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, as always, it's trying to collect funds to send to Haiti. We have funds. We're moving to Haiti. We need a lot more to send to Haiti to help the folks on the ground, particularly the medical teams, the mobile medical teams that are so important. Many of the people are unable to afford or have the resources otherwise to get to medical help. And the mobile medical teams, therefore, are critical family level loss.
Especially getting there immediately, right, in the afternoon?
Getting there immediately. Within the first 24 hours after a disaster becomes the most important time for initiating efforts to help. It helps to overcome the diseases that are going to be borne by the water, by the adverse conditions that people are under, injuries that need to be responded to immediately, trauma of various kinds that people will need help for. That's the experience in responding to disasters worldwide historically. That's also been part of the problem with Haiti. Much of the relief effort historically has been delayed.
Well, we saw that in 2010. The U.S. Marines landed, the U.S. military, they controlled the tarmac of the airport. There were actually entire medical units of Médecins Sans Frontières and of various governments that were not allowed to land in those crucial, critical hours following that earthquake. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I've talked about that before with you and with Dennis on this program and other places. That I was on the ground with my wife.
That's right, you were there during the earthquake.
At the time of the earthquake. And relief was not immediate. It took days for some places and weeks for others. People responded with what resources they had. And,
well, and then,
that's
just
happening
to be,
right now.
Just to be clear, it was done, it was justified as saying that the security situation demanded that relief be held back until the situation was stabilized or controlled.
Stabilizing the situation was stabilizing political control for U.S. Policies in Haiti, U.S. political friends, allies in Haiti, which, of course, did not include the grassroots movement, the mass movement, and particularly Flamme de la Valasse. The Aristide Foundation is now mobilizing folks, as they did in the 2010 earthquake, but has been reestablished, reorganized with a medical school, with forces there that can actually go out and work in the communities. So they have mobile clinics that are going, and they're calling for support and help, but they're going out. Anyway, we need to get supplies there. We need to get them funds.
Now, this is outside of the political campaign at this point. Nobody's concerned about that as much as there. I mean, of course, people are concerned about it, but the real priority is to help people immediately who need help.
That's what they're doing. They are out mobilizing the presidential candidate for Flamme de la Valasse. It's a doctor, a medical doctor, and she was out doing that at the earthquake. She did it during the previous hurricanes in Haiti. But that's what's happening right now. They're out with mobile teams that came out of the training at the medical school, out of the community, countryside, where people are mobilizing based upon the organization of Flamme de la Valasse. So they're using their organization right now to respond to the tragedy of the hurricane and its impact. Of course, they're saying that that's primary rather than the election campaign. But the ability for the country to respond depends upon who and what is the nature of the political leadership that's in power.
And, of course, under the previous government of Michel Martelly, we had billions of dollars of money that was raised through the Clinton Foundation, for example, the Clinton Global Initiative, through the Red Cross, through innumerable, even missionary groups. Just they raised tons of money.
Tons
but
of money.
But today we're seeing with this new disaster that, well, what does it mean?
The impact. Of this hurricane is greater because the money that was raised for Haiti was not used in Haiti. The money stayed offshore. Restructuring efforts didn't occur. Infrastructure wasn't rebuilt. Drainage ditches, overflow ditches.
All the things that you would think that should be dealt with in order to prepare for another disaster were not. The money was not spent that way.
Bill McKibbins just put out something on the internet. Bill McKibbins, the environmentalist, the person who is aware of the climate change and one of the leaders in the international movement around climate change, has talked about Haiti and understanding that we had to expect it's going to happen. The storms in the Atlantic are getting stronger and stronger every year, and it's because of climate change. The expectation is that it's going to create great damage to this hemisphere. We know that Haiti is going to be one of the places going to suffer. That was predictable, and will happen again. And until there is a government in place that starts to understand what it takes to meet the needs of the people, there will not be structural changes that can save people from the worst of these kinds of disasters. The differences between what can happen in Haiti and what happened in Cuba is amazing. What's going to happen in Florida when this hurricane, even of a less extent, though, will hit the U.S.? The devastation in Haiti is the power of the hurricane that is growing exponentially because of climate change, but also because of human actions. The failure to prepare the people, the failure to meet the needs of folks for evacuation, for housing, for clean water, the devastation that can result from natural disasters grows because of the lack of government, the lack of government participation, the lack of government benefiting the people.
Now, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We were on the phone with Ivan Canisan. He was giving us a live report from Haiti. We're going to try to get him back. But right now we have in the studio Walter Riley with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Well, Walter, there's also a new monster, if you will, that the Haitian people have to contend with, and that is the waterborne disease of cholera. And, of course, we have since learned that the United Nations was responsible for bringing that to Haiti, right?
Yes, that's been very well established, that the United Nations was responsible for bringing that, the troops, and the careless manner in which they dealt with their human waste, where the troops were had been exposed to cholera in Nepal. And the research has shown that that particular strain actually came from Nepal. So it's clear the United Nations was reluctant to admit that it was responsible for taking cholera to Haiti, and has fought the responsibility for some time. Now, unable to continue to resist in the onslaught of world opinion, scientific opinion, and proof. But the United Nations has not provided the resources necessary to eliminate cholera or to organize an effective campaign against cholera. So waterborne diseases are going to increase.
Like 10,000 people died as a result of that so far, right?
10,000 people.
And now we're talking about more as a result of waterborne diseases from this latest disaster. And then, I mean, compounded by the fact billions of dollars raised after the earthquake, none of it invested in infrastructure that would have helped people to this disaster. Then you've got cholera on top of it. And you had a government which was now being seen largely to have been involved in corruption. The Michel Martelly government absconded with a lot of money. And then on top of it, you had elections, which represented a change for the Haitian people, a change of the political landscape, two U.S. warships coming in, 300 U.S. Marines landing, still occupied by the United Nations military. Walter.
It's amazing the outrages that can be continued to be with Haiti, heaped upon the people of Haiti. Outrages that certainly exist for other places, but it seems to be in greater magnitude with Haiti. Warships going to Haiti and soldiers going to Haiti rather than medical supplies, rather than medical ships.
Well, there is one medical ship, but I understand they're also sending an aircraft carrier.
An aircraft carrier.
300 U.S. Marines along with medical folks.
There will be some medical supplies, but militarizing the relief effort seems to be paramount with Haiti. And I can remember being in discussions with folks who, and on panels with folks who had talked about relief efforts and after the tsunami, some of the experts from UC Berkeley and other places talk about the need to respond and the time most effective response is required and how much can be actually done. The tsunami and in other places, the responses have been faster and much more directed at resources that are useful rather than troops with guns, boots on the ground of that kind. And the U.S. responds to Haiti with soldiers, with troops, with a military ship. Yeah, they'll have some medical supplies and they will do some of that, but that's not apparently the primary approach. And until we have a lot more outrage, a lot more discussion, a lot more writing, a lot more criticism, let's say, of the way the U.S. responds in this hemisphere, then they will continue to do that. This should be a humanitarian response and not a military response. But I'd say that given the history of the U.S. State Department's position, government's position towards Haiti and towards politics in Haiti, politics is primary.
Well, of course, that's a big fear because we know the emerging popularity yet again of the Lavalas movement was the United States tried to keep Aristide in exile after the 2004 coup. We saw the murder of thousands and thousands of people. We also saw thousands and thousands of more lives destroyed, political prisoners. So we know that the United States foreign policy is no friend to Lavalas, and Lavalas has once again reemerged as one of the strongest political forces in Haiti. And I believe we have Yvonne Kernison back live to us from Port-au-Prince. Yvonne, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, and I'm very pleased to hear Walter and the way he approaches the situation. You were saying before I lost the signal that you heard that Jovenel is sending trucks of rice in Haiti. And I honestly think it's a good thing. It's a time for Haitians to put politics aside for a minute and be the humanitarian that we are. We've been with our ancestors were, and that we are called to be. And it is really a good thing.
So people know Jovenel Moïse is one of the presidential candidates running in the election. Yes.
Yes, yes. It is time to put political aside for a minute and be Haitian. And like Walter just said, and I don't think I could have said it better myself. It is not a time to send military or people. It's not a war, and we need help. But we need humanitarian help, not military help. And the other thing also is what it will cost the U.S. to ship all these people, all these soldiers to Haiti. The money would be much better utilized if it were used to just to help Haitians.
Now, I understand.
The other thing that worries us.
Now, I understand that not only is Jovenel Moïse sending relief, but I also understand that Lavalas presidential candidate Maurice Narcisse has also organized medical teams with the University of Aristide Foundation, and that they are actually dispatching teams throughout the country to also provide relief and cooperate in relief efforts as well. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, President Aristide went to which is in Cirque du Soleil yesterday, in the middle of the hurricane, because he wanted to be with the people that were more vulnerable when these things happened. Cirque du Soleil was very much affected by it, but the fact that they saw President Aristide and President Maurice Narcisse with them at that moment, where they were most vulnerable. To them, that is such a comfort. I know, Kevin, I know you saw the picture of that guy grabbing Dr. Narcisse and trying to lift her up.
Yeah, people were very happy to see that.
I will send it to you, but it is a picture to see.
Well, you know, also, just so people know. Cirque du Soleil is right on the coast. It's a very poor community, one of the poorest communities in the world, but also has been a stalwart base of support for Famille Lavalas. But more than that, it's also very low. And so there were reports of 5 to 10 foot surges of waves as a result of Hurricane Matthew passing over the island. And there was a big fear that Cirque du Soleil would be hit much harder than it was. It seemed as if this was mostly focused in the south and the southwest of the country.
Exactly, but the southwest of the entire south is underwater. But there are four of our states. You have southeast, mid, the south and Grandance. All four of these states are underwater. Right now, we're also having it. Yes.
This is Walter. Could you help us to understand a little bit more about why these places are hit so hard given the nature of the infrastructure. For example, having been in City Soleil, I know that a lot of it is on a floodplain, and the water relief efforts for floods has not been, this infrastructure has not been developed. Monies weren't spent to clean out those troughs. Canals. So you could talk about some of that a little bit for me and the rest of us and what's happening in the South. What would the infrastructure money that was already in the pockets of, in the accounts of many of these organizations, what would it have done if it had been spent in these places?
Right, the billions raised from the relief effort after the earthquake. Was it spent on infrastructure that would have helped during the damage of this hurricane?
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. And the other thing also is that all those NGOs which the name of City Soleil in the application, there are over 5,000 of them. And if each one would contribute at least $100 a month to City Soleil to work on the infrastructure and other needs of City Soleil would be a much different place. All these NGOs in that have their name in the application, they are using City Soleil, making money on the misery of the people living there. And it is an outrage, to say the least.
And that's throughout the country, right? I mean, that's throughout the country, though, right? I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars that could have been used to prevent against...
Exactly.
Right.
So just the canals and City Soleil would have made a difference.
People are a lot more familiar with the name City Soleil. They know it's a farm. They know there is a lot of misery there. They know the people need. So they're more inclined to donate money when they hear City Soleil.
Yes.
And this is what a lot of NGOs capitalize on.
But they didn't clean up. They didn't clean up the.
Nothing to do with City Soleil.
They didn't clean up the canals and the infrastructure development didn't happen.
Didn't build up
the
seaboard, right?
Didn't build up the seaboard and
breakers. They didn't put up breakers.
The breakers. All the things that could have been done that are fairly easy when you have the money. So the money was there, but the work wasn't done. And that would be true perhaps in other places, some of the housing in those places that wasn't there.
11,000 people are still homeless as a result of the earthquake, right? Who are living still in tents. Is that right?
Yes, but in addition to that, you have people that move to other people's houses temporarily. They have to go back to where they were living before, and to them, there is no place to go.
The other thing...
No place to go. They're talking about 11,000 people. That's nothing. It's going to be a lot more than that.
Are you talking about nationally?
Say that again?
Are you talking nationally or...
Voice of Walter Riley.
No, just around City Soleil.
Oh.
Just around City Soleil. The people that have they have to go back to where they were living before.
Uh-huh.
In those shanty houses, most of them are no longer there.
Or there is now mud and...
In tents, exactly.
Well, let me remind you.
All the garbage that people throw when it's raining... It all just ends up in City Soleil.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, Yvonne Kenny-San, coming to us live from Haiti. We're discussing the devastation left in the wake of Hurricane Matthew, which hit day before yesterday, and at least 11 people have died. We're talking about how the billions and billions of dollars of aid that was raised for Haiti, very little of it was put into the infrastructure to help against another, forestall the effects of another natural disaster. And, of course, a lot of people are asking, what happened to that money? Also in studio is Walter Riley of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Finally, Yvonne, before I let you go, I want to ask you, what about the postponement of the elections, and how do you see this ultimately affecting the impact?
Well, for the people who base their campaign on money, it's going to be a big hit on them. Because I think the election is going to be held on the 23rd. This is my guess. But if
October
you have another in addition to 2 weeks, you have people that were throwing that money with all they were throwing in their campaign. To us, coronavirus, it's not going to make much of a difference to us because we run a campaign of service. We're going to have to do more of those health care. We're going to be helping more people. But this is what we do. So it's not going to be, have a big impact on us. But we have the other candidates, that the ones that are paying basically people when they have those rallies and whatnot, they're going to be affected a lot more than coronavirus. And like Dr. Nancy said it at the press conference today, I'm sure you heard it, it's just going to add to the margin of our success.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there with you.
In these elections.
Well, thank you, Yvonne. I'm going to come back to you again soon, but thank you so much for sharing your views. Of course, our thoughts and our prayers are with you there in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, as you clean up in the devastation, the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew. I also want to remind our listeners that this Sunday, October the 9th, there's going to be a special benefit for Haiti and for the Love Not Blood campaign, the continuation of the movement for Oscar Grant. It's going to be at 7 o'clock at the Omni Commons, which is at 4799 Shattuck Avenue. Again, that's this Sunday, October the 9th. It's a benefit screening of my film, #OO, Occupy Oakland, celebrating the fifth anniversary of the takeover of Oscar Grant Plaza in 2011. And now in studio is Walter, the last word, Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. What can we do to help? What's the website?
HaitiEmergencyRelief.org, www.HaitiEmergencyRelief.org. HaitiEmergencyRelief.org. Push the button and give money. The money will be distributed in Haiti, every penny of it. The other thing is, come to the event on Sunday, because those of us in Haiti Emergency Relief and the Haiti Action Committee will be there. There will be some sharing of the proceeds, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to you more, answer some questions, and talk some about the complicated events that are occurring this weekend. We were hoping to be able to announce the victory of Lava Loss, a mass movement that many of us in the Bay Area give a tremendous amount of support to and hope for the dignity and for democracy for Haiti. But Sunday, we will be collecting some money and asking for donations for Haiti, and come be part of this film showing, see what this discussion is. But this movement for social justice, whether it's Oakland, the state, the nation, Central America, or the rest of the world, we're all part of that, and those of us in the struggle for Haiti and democracy there are much part of this.
You could take it all in pills. Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. Time's running on the ceiling, man. Break the laws of gravity every time we shoot. And you land there. And I give it to you. And he landed. Oh, 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 oh. You like my FFO. You like my FFO. Light up my room, you love. Oh, 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 oh. You like my FFO. You like my FFO. Light up my room, you love. So, floating in the air, on the floor, on the walls, open halls. Bathroom stalls, hourglass figure on your finger. See me later. Got my mind spinning faster than a crater. Handstand in the orbit. See a plan. Hands all the massive things imported. Excuse me, my mind. Oh, vicious love making break the laws of physics. Moon rising.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of October 7th, 2016. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature our recent interview with Puerto Rican Jewish feminist, poet, author, and activist, Aurora Levins Morales. Listen to this.
Aurora Levins Morales is a nationally known Puerto Rican Jewish feminist writer and activist. She's the author of Medicine Stories, Remedios, Stories of Earth and Iron from the History of Puerto Ricanas, and Kindling, Writings on the Body, and co-authored two books with her mom, Rosario Morales. She created the Vehicle for Change Project to research, design, fund, and build her chemically accessible mobile home, and is currently traveling around the United States writing, well, she's just beginning here on Flashpoints, writing about the confluence, as I said, of ecology, health, and social justice struggles from her radio blog, Letters from Earth. It is broadcast on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. She's also a member of the Jews of Color Caucus, working in partnership with Jewish Voice for Peace and the Jewish Voice for Peace Artist Council. She writes and performs with Sins Invalid, a Bay Area disability justice performance project. And, oh, there are so many things to talk about. Aurora Levins Morales, maybe some folks would remember the amazing poem that you wrote the day after 9/11. I'm talking about the 9/11 that happened in New York City, not the overthrow of Allende by the U.S. government. But welcome back.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Why don't you say a little bit about Letters from Earth, what motivated it, and what this project means to you, what you're trying to do?
This is really something I've been dreaming about for years. It's an opportunity to be out in the world as a working poet, responding to what I see and researching the backstories and telling the stories through the filter of my own experience, my own body. I'm somebody who has a lot of environmentally caused illnesses, and so I feel a real connection personally in my own flesh with what happens to the planet. I was exposed to heavy pesticides as a child in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is also contaminated by a very strong U.S. military presence. I live at that confluence that I'm trying to write about. And I started out building this mobile home because conventional housing made me sick, but also because I wanted to be able to move around the country and engage more directly with people. I had spent many years sick in bed and really kind of living my life through the internet. So at the moment, I'm speaking to you from a berry field in western Massachusetts.
Is that cranberries?
No, it's raspberries and blueberries and blackberries and elderberries and red currants and black currants and all kinds of delicious things that are ripening and being picked all around me.
Sounds like sort of multicultural berries of color.
Well, when I get too stressed out with all my internet work, I just go pick some raspberries for the owner of the farm and it mellows me right out.
Nice. And let's talk a little bit about that mobile unit, which it took you a bit of time to put together, really raise the money to put together. But I say it's a mobile radio station, but that's almost true.
Well, it's a studio. It's a broadcast station. It's my home. It's a kind of research vessel.
Aurora, let's do this, just so we give people a taste. I'm not going to call it poetry because then people head for the doors because most of them have had poetry teachers who hated poetry. So let's start and give people a sense of what you mean by poetry. And let's start, with this first one. What's the title? What's the title of the first one?
I'm not really giving them titles.
Letter one.
Correct.
All right, let's listen to it.
I thought my first letter from Earth would be to the sound of rain falling on the mountain where I was born. The sweet piercing cries of the coquis and the voices of lizard cuckoos crying wildly in the valleys. I thought I would sing the resilience of the land with its beauty and sorrow, that place that both birthed and poisoned me. But each time I sit down to write about Puerto Rico, there are 10 new daggers in my heart, 10 new ways the imperialists have found to ravage our lives. and I can't breathe. This month, I hear that they want to privatize and sell off El Junque, our sacred rainforest, the green, cloud-wrapped home of our indigenous gods, and also the scarred beaches of Vieques, so recently liberated and still sick with toxins from half a century of U.S. bombing practice. Who builds resorts on land contaminated with heavy metals and radioactivity? Speculators do. That the CDC has stopped monitoring water quality, that the Zika virus is in explosive ascent, cases multiplying daily, growing by 20 to 30% a week, perhaps as many as 80,000, hundreds of pregnant women infected, no money to support the small-headed children who will come. And the EPA refuses to close illegally run landfill sites full of standing water where pesticide-resistant mosquitoes breed in great clouds so dense that the people living near them can't go out at dusk. And our already dying healthcare system is expected to collapse any day now as doctors flee and funding evaporates or is held in the tight grasp of a Congress that doesn't even pretend to value our lives. That 10 more public beaches where my island people meet the sea and find ease and fish for their dinners and wash the day from their skins are to be reserved for rich foreigners who despise us. That sick children can't get dialysis, that university students can't afford to eat, and Orrin Hatch will head the junta that has been given absolute powers to ransack our economy for the remaining crumbs of loot. I said I was going to write about the rain-hung mountains, about the people of the coffee region, about my childhood among the jagrumo trees, about dieldrin and DDT and my liver. But my people are encamped in front of the federal courthouse in San Juan to protest this coup and shouting in the streets that we will not be sprayed with NALID, which the CDC just shipped to Puerto Rico without asking us if we wanted it, deciding for us what was best. Although NALID causes nervous system damage and lung problems and kills fish and birds and bees, and I can't breathe, because they also didn't ask when they tested Agent Orange on us, or GM crops, or birth control pills, or when they tested the toxicity of AIDS drugs by giving them to young children, or injected cancer cells into anemia patients, or released dengue-infected mosquitoes in poor neighborhoods to see how fast the disease would spread. I was raised to hold the long and radical view, to be a caretaker of the deep wells of hope, to use my skill with language to feed the big dreams we have been bullied into abandoning. I was raised to respond to oppression by gathering people together to act, by speaking, by standing in the public square with my poems in hand. I was raised to believe that solidarity is the greatest force on earth. But right now I'm having some trouble finding it. We are stunned and staggering and pulling ourselves together for the fight, but the bad news is an avalanche of stones 523 years old, and it's burying my own well of hope. I need you to be angry beside me, to be outraged at 1,900% profit rolling in for the vulture funds while they demand that we shut down schools and health care, sell off our mountains, rivers, forests, golden sands, and go hungry in order to pay them. Puerto Rico is becoming an island of ghost towns, so I need you to tell everyone you know that they are murdering my country right before our eyes, that this so-called debt is a scam, a way to rob us first and then bill us for the robbery. Part of the international business of plunder by those who can never get enough. I am suffocating because I can't tell if anyone outside our familia has noticed. Solidarity has been slow to build, and solidarity is the source of air. So I need you to get up and shout. I need to hear a whole lot of you shouting, let her people go, shouting U.S. out of Puerto Rico, shouting repay the last 118 years of theft and Puerto Rico will be fine, shouting you can't do this to our Boricua kin, so I can take a good deep lungful of oxygen. Because without air, how can I write the words of fire I need to write? How can I write water for our desperate thirst? How can I write manifestos full of hurricane? I promise I will write those words of fire and water and wind. Write them about Linka Flegel, the radical Jewish chicken farm in rural New York where I've been staying. About Wild Seed and Soulfire Farm and Harriet's Apothecary, women of color-led initiatives that cultivate the healing of people and earth. About the ties between Vieques and Gaza. About the threat to our waters in Flint and the Louisiana Gulf Coast and the Navajo Nation and the San Bernardino Valley and the upper Missouri where Standing Rock has become a deep line in the earth. About GM crops from the U.S. imposed as food aid on the Maasai of East Africa, destroying local agriculture and subsidizing corporate farming. About Casa Pueblo, eco-activists of the Puerto Rican mountains, teaching young people in the school of the forest. About living in my solar land boat and the purple-fingered joys of Bug Hill Farm in berry season. But without breath, the words faint away inside of me. So get up and shout right now and help me breathe in my people's strength, our resilience, our courage, and the proof that we are not alone. And then I will exhale words.
The voice of Aurora Levins Morales. She is now on a project traveling around the country in her own created, accessible, chemically accessible mobile home. And let's talk a minute about that, because that's huge. It's not, I mean, this is a major problem for millions of folks, many who don't even know that the reason that they can't breathe or they have trouble getting up in the morning or they have constant headaches is because the environment around them is deadly.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of places, indoor air is even more toxic than the outdoor air. The construction materials, formaldehyde, outgassing from furniture, from gas appliances, it's really a serious problem. And there are a lot of people, increasing numbers of people, who are becoming very ill from it and then get sensitized to all sorts of common chemicals. It's part of the whole spread of in what we call environmental justice, that, you know, the for-profit society prioritizes making money over our well-being in every realm, whether we're talking about fracking or we're talking about air freshener, from the most domestic to the largest scale, that everywhere both the body of the planet and our bodies are being sacrificed in order to make people rich. So about there was a survey done that 60% of people with multiple chemical sensitivities have spent time living in their cars, living in tents, being homeless. And those are the people who get that diagnosis. Many people of color in poor communities don't have access to the kind of health care where their doctors would talk about multiple chemical sensitivity. And so the numbers are, I'm sure, much, much higher than what we're told.
And in those communities of color, poor communities where you will be heading in your vehicle, are most devastated, and they have the least chance of getting help or finding out what's being done to them, right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody is affected by the consequences of contamination, but they fall most quickly and heavily on people who are already vulnerable because of inequality, exploitation, living in communities that many, many toxic waste dumps are situated in communities of color. When you look at the situation of Standing Rock right now, they didn't want to run the pipeline through communities farther north. They thought it was fine to run it right close to the reservation. You can look at West Berkeley. You can look at people of color and poor communities all over the country tend to have much higher concentrations of toxins. We're considered as expendable as the rivers, the forests, the oceans, wildlife, by those who control our economies.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I'm going to be going to what I'm calling frontline communities where people are heavily impacted and are organizing in response to it. But I'm also going to be visiting places where people are creating really alternatives. There are a number of really interesting food justice projects that I've come across just in the few weeks that I've been living in my vehicle. I've been spending time in rural New York, There's a project there called Wild Seed by a collective of people of color who are on a big piece of land that they're developing into a healing and food justice and organizing center. And one of the things they're looking at is how prisons are replacing farming in upstate New York. And the people who are ending up in those prisons are coming from food desert neighborhoods in New York City, people of color in poor working class neighborhoods where you can't buy fresh food. So one of the projects there is helping bring families to visit family members who are in prison and also supplying them with fresh produce that they can both give to their relatives where that's allowed and take back to their community. So linking the struggle around prison justice and food justice. So those are some of the kinds of projects that I'm really interested in finding out about. And most of the people doing that kind of work are way too busy doing it to find out about the next project down the road. So part of my work is to connect people who are thinking about similar kinds of projects.
Once again, the water carrier. Aurora yep. Levins Morales on a journey, a beautiful journey, Letters from Earth. She will be doing pieces as she travels around the country in her chemically accessible mobile home. I want to ask you, Aurora, just as an aside, what does it say about the U.S. government and current policy that not only is Puerto Rico still a colony, but after years of devastating military experimentation, there's now a vulture raid. What does that say about the current state of the United States and how we carry forth?
Well, I think it's about the permanent state of the United States. It's an extension of the entire structure of plunder that underlies the building of this country. Puerto Rico was seized in 1898, and U.S. companies, with the support of their government, have been plundering the island ever since. Puerto Rico has been used for all kinds of experimentation, as I said in the letter. This escalation of plundering is part of a trend. The same companies that are plundering Puerto Rico's economy and insisting that we shut down schools and healthcare and everything else in order to pay these incredibly inflated interest rates. It's the same companies that have been active in Greece, in Argentina, and they specialize in buying up human misery and then charging huge amounts of interest. They bought Puerto Rico's debt at 5 cents on the dollar, so they're getting 1,900% return on
1,900%. Boy, that's
yeah.
pretty good.
Yeah, it's really obscene. And, you know, we are organizing in response to it both on the island and the mainland. But, you know, it's not a unique situation to Puerto Rico, even though it's horrific what's going on there. It's really how U.S. capitalism and imperialism affects places all over the world.
Indeed. And, well, that's a good segue. Perhaps one of the most polluted based on U.S. collaborations with Israel is the Gaza Strip, where kids are dying from polluted, terribly polluted water. The air is impossible to breathe. And that's, you know, if they get a chance to breathe it and they're not wiped out by the latest weapons tests by the Israelis supported by the United States government. I would love to play Wings for Gaza. You want to say a little bit about the poem?
Yeah. I actually wrote it years ago in response to the question I kept getting, what kind of a Jew are you? Because I was committed to Palestinian liberation, and it draws on the ties between the island of Vieques and Puerto Rico, where many of the weapons used in Gaza were in fact tested, and people in Puerto Rico are suffering from many of the same kinds of health problems as people in Gaza because the same chemicals we've been exposed to. So yeah, this was a poem that I wrote, I think, in 2004. But it's
incredibly relevant. Let's listen. Yeah.
I wrote this poem because both as a Jew of color and one who is passionate supporter of the rights of the Palestinian people to safety and sovereignty, I am often faced with the question, spoken or unspoken, what kind of Jew are you? I wrote it because as a Puerto Rican who is Jewish, who has spent 40 years organizing against injustice, and who grieves for what Israeli colonialism has done to the souls of Jewish people, there's also the question, why do you care what happens to the perpetrators and witnesses of colonial violence? What kind of activist of color are you? The weapons being used in Gaza were made in the United States and tested on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. This is the kind of Jewish Boricua activist poet I am. Wings. Cuba y Puerto Rico son de un pájaro las dos alas. Reciben flores y balas en el mismo corazón. Cuba and Puerto Rico are two wings of one bird, receiving flowers and bullets into the same heart. Lola Rodriguez de Tio. Two wings of one bird, said the exiled writer, whose words burned too many holes of truth through the colonial air of an earlier iron-toothed occupation. Nothing divides the suffering of the conquered. Two wings, she said, of a single bird, with one heart between them, taking bullets and roses, soldiers and prison bars and poetry into one pulse of protest. One bird, she insisted, as the ship pulled away from San Juan, headed for Havana, 1879. A century later, we are still the wounded wing, fluttering, dragged through the waves, the next empire plucking feathers from living flesh. White egret within the foam, cried the poet, returning after long years in the dry solitudes of Spain. Garza, Garza Blanca. Those ruffled reefs are infested now with unexploded bombs. Pastures where white birds still grace the backs of cattle are dusted with the toxic waste of rehearsal for invasion that seeps into the blood of children, so that cancer is a required course in the high schools of Vieques, giving a whole new meaning to the term, drop out. I was born into an occupied country. I am that wing. What kind of Jew are you, receiving bullets and roses as if in a Palestinian heart? I am the Jewish great-great-granddaughter of Puerto Rican slaveholders. I am the Puerto Rican great-great-granddaughter of Ukrainian socialists. I am the surviving branch of a family tree split at the turn of the last century, holding the photograph of nameless cousins who missed the last train to Siberia and fell into the trenches of summer as Nazi armies rolled across the farmlands of Kherson. I am the educated granddaughter of a Puerto Rican seamstress who never went past the eighth grade, whose fingers bled into the spandex of sweatshop assembly line girdles, a long subway ride from the barrios where she lived. The granddaughter of an electrician wiring battleships in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, of a communist studying law at night and serving deli by day, and of a social worker trying to plug the holes in immigrant lifeboats. I am a daughter of occupation and conquest, of deportation and escape. I am a daughter of people who were outgunned and refused to die. I am a colonial subject with a stone in my hand when I listen to the news. I am a fierce Latina Jew holding out a rose to Palestine. I am the Jewish grandniece of a Puerto Rican World War II soldier cracking up in the bloody Pacific in the service of an army that always sent the brown men in first. I am the Puerto Rican cousin of Jewish evacuees trying to flee eastward, shot in the back by Ukrainian collaborators who live just down the road. I am the daughter of red pacifists married in the year of Korea, a two-winged child conceived as the Rosenbergs died, born as Lolita was shackled into her quarter century of punishment for shooting into the air. I was born Jewish in an occupied Caribbean land, speaking Spanish with the accent of escaped slaves and hungry coffee laborers, because my great-grandfather would not fight Japan for the Tsar, because he evaded yet another imperial draft and washed up in New York City, where barrio meets shtetl, girl meets boy, and solidarity was my lullaby. What kind of independentista are you to weep for Israeli soldiers drafted into accepting atrocity as a fact of life, beating out the ritmo of Kaddish for colonialists killed in rightful revolution on the conga of your Caribe heart? I am the proud cousin of a banned Boricua writer climbing out of his deathbed to raise the flag of Puerto Rico on the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion, just 2 weeks before he died of TB, contracted in the bitter prison cells of Valladolid. I am a distant relative of the first woman of Puerto Rico burned by the Inquisition in the name of Christ for being a secret Jew. I am the descendant of hacendados who worked their own slave children to the bone in tobacco fields ripening over the traces of uprooted plantings of cassave, and of the pale brown daughters of dark women taken into the marriage beds of landholding men, criada servants deemed good enough for younger sons, setting their wide cheeks and mouths into their children's bones. I am the descendant of invaders and invaded, now riding high on history's wheel, now crushed below, of those evicted and their village burned, of those who rode the horses and set the flames. What kind of song is this? Whose side are you on? Two wings, I say, with the exiled poets of my country, to my dispossessed and dispossessing cousins in the land it seems that everyone was promised. Two wings with a single heart between them, intifada and partisaner, refusnik and cimarron. Nothing divides the suffering. One bird full of bullets and roses, one bird with its wounded pinions, one heart that if it breaks is broken. I know there are two bloody wings, but it is one bird trying to lift itself into the air, one bird turning in circles on the ground, because two wings rising and falling together is the forgotten principle of flight. Two wings torn by tempestuous weather, one bird struggling into the light.
Aurora Levins Morales, and she is on a marvelous project. She is traveling around the country in her chemically accessible mobile home, writing these letters from Earth, and we are delighted, Flashpoints is, to be in this collaboration, one more collaboration with our poet on assignment, has been working with the show for many years and has been doing spectacular things, writing books, incredible poems, and I'm going to have to read a couple of those medicine stories again because I'm feeling horrible and I can use some inspiration. But, Aurora, people who maybe want your mobile unit to stop by, who you talked about hooking up one project with another, sort of being the water carrier, as you like to sort of talk about the work that you do. People can get in touch with you. They can, maybe you can stop by their movement.
Absolutely, yes. My website is AuroraLevinsMorales.com, and you can look at my itinerary there. You can read my written blog post and support the project. You can find out what events I'm going to be doing, and certainly you can write and offer me a field or a parking lot, place to pull up my vehicle. I will be traveling probably for the next several years, so there's a lot of opportunity.
Good luck. We talk to you soon. Safe journey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, journalist, essayist, and activist Chris Hedges speaks ad lib, and speaks very well indeed. I hope you'll stay tuned. Chris Hedges speaks ad lib on New World Notes today. I've been producing this show for 8 years. When I began, Chris Hedges barely registered on my radar. Other voices from the left were louder and clearer. That was then. Now, 8 years later, Noam Chomsky is still out there, actively fighting the good fight. Michael Parenti has been speaking less than he had been, though. Both of these men are now in their 80s. And since the show began, Howard Zinn has died. George Carlin has died. Gore Vidal has died. Too many fine, radical voices have been stilled. Just last night, I was reading a book of Gore Vidal's essays. The essay I was reading began by reminding us that the word radical comes from the Latin for root. A person who tries to get at the root of a problem is called a radical, often sneeringly by established power. Established power doesn't want the roots of society's problems exposed, because established power is profiting nicely from those problems. That's why our nation's phony political debates are so depressing and irrelevant. Because nobody is permitted to dig anywhere near the root of our problems. Not with all our mass media and both political parties owned and operated by the U.S. corporate oligarchy. That's not me speaking, incidentally. Gore Vidal wrote all that back in 1992. Sharp guy. Every major American institution now serves corporate power. That's why the radical imagination and radical voices are so important today, and so hard to find. That's why it was such a bummer to lose George Carlin and Howard Zinn and Gore Vidal. Who will take their place? Then, pretty much out of the blue, comes Chris Hedges. Or so it seemed to me. He's got the attitude we need, and the critical habits of mind, and the moral compass, and formal education, too. B.A. from Colgate, Master's from Harvard Divinity School. Then, 15 years' experience as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Spent a lot of time in war zones. A few weeks ago, New World Notes played Hedges' recent speech in Seattle called The Algebra of Revolution. That was a fine talk. If you missed it, feel free to go to our website and download a free copy. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Like Michael Parenti and Noam Chomsky, Hedges is often very good at speaking impromptu, without a script. In the question and answer session that followed his Seattle talk, Hedges did just that. We'll hear some of that now. In the first part of today's program, Hedges speaks about the corruption of our judicial system, the perfidy of the banks, the irrationality of the bank bailout beginning 2008. He explores whether Obama had good intentions and failed to deliver, or was he just jiving us all along? Hedges also speaks of the propaganda from our corporate-controlled media and of the bad effects of uncontrolled corporate power. Here is Chris Hedges.
We had some really good news out of Spokane, Washington this week, where a judge ruled that three individuals that had been tortured by the U.S. government had the right to sue the government. I'm wondering if you're seeing other points of light in the legal system that you could shed some light on for us tonight.
Well, there are points of light, including there are judges that ruled after the Snowden revelations that, as Al Gore said, this was a crime against the Constitution. But the superstructure itself shuts down those individuals of conscience. I mean, there is no way to justify giving the U.S. Constitution the surrender of our privacy. It cannot be done legally. There is no way to justify under our Constitution the use of the military as a domestic police force. There is no way, I think, to justify the absurd idea that corporations are human beings and have a right to drop dark money into our elections. So I think the court system, while you can get singular individuals, the weight of the institution nullifies what they've done. I mean, the issue of privacy, I think I found that the inability of our system to respond to give us back our privacy, I found quite frightening.
I wanted to address the financial terrorism from the banks. As we know, after the bailout, 8 years later, they're still rampant with fraudulent deeds. Iceland broke up the banks.
Right. Well, they put bankers in jail.
Put them in jail, because I think if we just fine them, it's another tax write-off.
Right.
So I think we have to hold them accountable and jail them.
Well, they never get fined. I mean, Goldman Sachs just paid $5 billion, which is nothing for Goldman Sachs. And actually, you know, that's kind of, if you look at the fine print, they're never going to pay $5 billion. But nobody's held accountable. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein should be in prison. Most of my students should be out of prison.
So it's like, would you break up the banks and do state banks?
Yeah, I'm with Ralph Nader. We need to nationalize the banking system. Yeah.
Thank you.
Along with public transportation, along with the utilities, private companies have no right owning water or electricity. Yeah, and you know, at the bailout in 2008, Nader said, why are we giving trillions of dollars to Citibank? Why aren't we creating public banks with our money? And why aren't these public banks renegotiating these fraudulent mortgages so that people are not forced out of their homes? This is a rational response. You know, the bailout bill of 2008 had no public support. Constituent calls were 100 to 1 against the bailout. It doesn't matter. When we sued Obama under the NDAA, they did a national poll. It had a 97% disapproval rating. But it passed anyway. Nobody wants the TPP, or at least we've seen what NAFTA does, and the TPP is NAFTA on steroids. We get it. We get trade agreements. We know what they're about. And there's an extremely good chance that as soon as these elections are over in November, these people are going to go in and pass it.
Do you think Obama ever had good intentions when he was campaigning, or do you think he knew all the bad things he's going to do when he got in?
Well, the difference between Barack Obama and George W. Bush is that George W. Bush was as stupid as he looks and clueless. And Obama, I think, was cynical. Obama is smart. He knew damn well what he was doing. He was only 2 years in the Senate. But Kucinich gave me his voting record. He said, you better read it, because it is one corporate giveaway after another. In that sense, I don't care what they say. I mean, they spend a lot of money on public relations. I care how they vote. And one of the problems with Sanders is that, yes, he voted against the war in Iraq, but he subsequently voted for the military appropriations to keep these wars going and the money for national security. So I think Obama played us. And I think if you look at Susskind's book, or where there's kind of reporting behind the veil, that I mean, remember, he's a product of the Chicago political machine, which is one of the dirtiest machines in the country. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I also ran a lobby organization in the 80s when Reagan was doing the Iran-Contra affair, Hanford, START Treaty, and we were very successful. We got what we wanted. And, you know, we had 60,000 members behind us, and I sent people week to week after that. But I don't even think that we can do that anymore. I really don't think that the people's voices can be heard anymore if I even set up a lobby organization to send individuals to Congress.
Right. Well, look, you make a good point, because, and this gets into the destruction of our media. Clinton, which did a lot of damage to working men and women in this country, deregulated the FCC. So we allowed roughly a half dozen corporations to buy up the airwaves, Viacom, Comcast, General Electric, Murdoch's News Corp. And at the same time, public radio and public television was destroyed and became dependent on corporate money or grant money, which is Democratic or corporate money. So that on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, on Morning Edition, who are they interviewing? Wolfowitz. Reverentially. So what have we learned, you know? And so as people resist, we saw this with the Iraq War. Hundreds of thousands of people marching San Francisco, not covered. Totally blocked out. And so that is a difference. In the 60s, CBS, and they would all have the cameras down in Birmingham. And it's all become about ratings. I mean, it's much more pernicious than the old newspaper empires, like the Hearst Empire, which were bad enough. He kind of gave us the Spanish-American War and the advent of American imperialism overseas. But now it's a giant corporation where news is just one of perhaps hundreds of revenue streams, and they compete against those other revenue streams. So it's all about advertising or ratings. And there's been an utter destruction, especially on the commercial media, of the news industry. So you're right. You raise a good point. It is much harder for the voice, the unapproved or unsanctioned voices of the citizenry to be heard. And that's dangerous, because the more they shut us down, I mean, you look at the Occupy movement. So you have this relatively benign, they weren't quite as revolutionary as they thought, movement that asks for very rational things, jobs, universal health care, and the state eradicates them physically. Now, a rational response would have been a jobs program, would have been health care, would have been a moratorium on student debt. All that would have been rational. But because corporate power is now unfettered and uncontrolled, And because they don't, as a writer in the New Yorker said, they don't live in America, they live in Richistan. They're not sitting next to you on the economy seat in Delta. They don't have any clue. And when societies disintegrate, and you can look at the Forbidden City, Versailles, they retreat into these worlds that are utterly unplugged from what's happening around them, and yet they have total power. And so they're making decisions without understanding the consequences. And that's where we are, and that's why it's dangerous. Because they have no conception. I mean, you see it, how knocked off balance they have been by this political campaign. You see it on the TV with the chattering, all the courtiers posing as television journalists. So you're right. It's harder. You're right.
But what do we do, though? I mean,
we have to get out there and just keep fighting anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, so keep going. Yeah.
Yeah.
On New World Notes, you're listening to Chris Hedges, speaking impromptu in April 2016. Hedges now discusses some familiar themes: how the Democratic Party betrayed its voters and sold out to corporate interests, how the system is incapable of internal reform, and how the only viable response we can make to this is nonviolent rebellion. Back to Chris Hedges.
Well, it wasn't quite extortion. What happened, it really came, rose with Clinton's understanding that if he did corporate bidding, he got corporate money. So that's how you got NAFTA. That's how you got the destruction of the welfare system originally. Under our old welfare system, 70% of those recipients were children. That's how you get the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994 that explodes the prison population. That's how you get the destruction of Glass-Steagall, FCC. And by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Obama ran in 2008, he got more. So basically what you had was a Democratic establishment that did have at one point a liberal wing that decided to sell itself out completely. And that's why Nader ran for president, because I think 24 pieces of major health, safety, and environmental legislation were written by Ralph Nader, but pushed through the Congress by that liberal wing of the Democratic Party that no longer exists. And that, unfortunately, now has become the system that governs. So it's, you know, it's one bird of prey with two wings.
Can we get this done without a French-like revolution?
I don't think that we can work with corporate power. I think corporate power must be destroyed or overthrown. I'll repeat that for the Homeland Security person. That's overthrown. No, I think we've reached a point where the system is incapable of internal reform. And I obviously want to see a revolutionary movement that's nonviolent. And I watched it in Eastern Europe. I mean, in the Stasi state of East Germany, which was the most efficient police state until our own. And there, it followed the classic pattern of revolutions whereby, as the demonstrations grew in Leipzig, Erich Honecker, who'd been the communist dictator for 19 years, sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to shoot the crowd. And when the paratroopers got to Leipzig, the Communist Party officials in Leipzig forbade them to deploy in the streets. And Honecker was out within a week. These regimes that are this decayed, as ours is, can crumble very quickly. Once those who are tasked with employing the brute mechanisms of control will no longer do so. That's how the Russian Revolution was a non-violent. Yes, there was anarchist violence, and Alexander II was assassinated, but it fundamentally fell through non-violence. When the Petrograd bread riots happened, the Cossacks were sent in, and they refused to fire on the crowd. So the Tsar is up on the front. They shove him in the imperial rail carriage. He abdicates on a railway siding. He didn't even make it back. That is true in every revolution. So once the system is discredited, we had 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz in East Germany, 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square in Prague, and that discredited elite. And it doesn't matter how many weapons they have. The Shah of Iran had the fourth largest military in the world at the time. But once he fled, the armed forces issued a statement that they would not protect the regime. That is how revolutions happen. It gets into the Bolshevik Revolution, which, as Adam Ullmann, the great scholar of the revolution, says, was in fact a counter-revolution. The destruction of decentralized power, the Soviets, Lenin and the Bolsheviks create a paramilitary faction with the Red Guards. They go in October and violently take control and then impose a form of state capitalism. And revolutions are always susceptible to counter-revolutions. This is what happened in Romania in particular, which I also covered, where Ceausescu was overthrown. You had a few days where workers took over the factories, and then the Securitate showed up again. But we have more power than we, I think. And once we begin to exercise that power, it becomes apparent. You can see it on video, probably on YouTube. But Ceausescu would hold his annual meetings when they'd bus all the workers into the square. And it's an amazing moment in history. And he's up on the balcony with his wife, Elena. And eventually the crowd just starts booing and hissing. Was unthinkable in Romania. And you watch him in a panic, and you watch him in the microphone suddenly start offering reforms. And then he's helicoptered out. And we have that power if we use it. And it's time to use it.
So far, Chris Hedges has stayed on familiar ground. But then he addresses a subject I've never heard him talk about before. Someone asks him a question about the attempts by some pressure groups to brand all criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. In fact, the California legislature did just that in 2012 with its notorious House Resolution 35. Hedges replies with a clear and forceful condemnation of the government of Israel, of AIPAC and similar pressure groups, and of all attacks on freedom of speech. He speaks in favor of the BDS movement, calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until that country's government ends its half-century-long military occupation and blockade against Palestine. I've never heard Hedges speak on the subject before, and here he's not pulling any punches.
Recently, the state of California passed Resolution 35. Are you familiar with it?
Which is it?
Resolution 35.
Right, but what is it?
Which stated that you cannot say anything negative against the state of Israel.
Oh, right.
And especially in the academic world.
Right.
How could they possibly have passed that resolution when we do have the right to freedom of speech?
Well, we have the right of freedom of speech as long as it is set within the parameters they give us, which, as Dorothy Parker once said about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress, runs from A to B. And if you step outside those parameters, you have no voice. So what is the debate about Syria? Should we bomb them, or should we bomb them and put boots on the ground? As if those are the two options. Well, I'm a strong supporter of the BDS movement. Israel is terrified because it's taken off in Europe. Sander doesn't like me too much, and one of the reasons he doesn't like me is because right after he and every other senator voted for that AIPAC resolution when they were bombing Gaza, about Israel's right to defend itself, he and I spoke in Wisconsin, and as soon as he finished, I got up and spoke about Palestine and called him and every other senator an AIPAC wind-up doll. I mean, are you really, it's like the old Soviet Union. Are you telling me there isn't one senator who opposes the saturation bombing of a people that do not have an air force, mechanized units, artillery, a navy? That's not a war. It's murder. And the Israeli government has used the mechanism that powerful entities, the gun lobby, corporations use, and that's money. They've bought these people off. And if you challenge them, they will use their considerable resources to destroy you. But it's interesting, I speak to students for Justice Palestine at all sorts of universities, and invariably when I meet with them, half of them are Jewish. You know, young Jewish men and women with a conscience. And that scares Israel tremendously, and they have every right to be scared. So what they're doing is banning these movements, Northeastern, other Florida State, others, it follows a very familiar pattern where not only are the movements banned, but all of the students who are in that movement are stripped of their positions of leadership in the university. So when I was at Northeastern, I was there a week after they banned it, for putting up mock eviction notices to draw attention of the seizure of Palestinian homes by Israelis. There was a student in that group who was president of the student council. He was stripped of his position. It's nothing to do with Israel. They remove, and then they put them all on probation. But ultimately, that's going to be very counterproductive for Israel, I think. The fact that they have overreacted to BDS to such an extent shows how frightened they are. And I just spoke to about 300 BDS activists in Washington. All of my energy goes into movement. I will vote third party unless the Green Party doesn't make it on the ballot in New Jersey. Then I'll write in Edward Snowden. I'm not going to play their game. And the sooner large numbers of us step out and stop playing their game, the more trouble they're going to be in. Thank you.
You've been listening to Chris Hedges, Ad Lib, speaking in Seattle last April 2016. Thanks to Pirate Radio Seattle for the video recording. I have edited the audio for radio broadcast. Speaking of audio, you can find recordings of all of our shows on the web. We're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, reminding you that an injury to one is an injury to all, and hoping you'll come back again next week. We started this show lamenting some radical voices we had lost. Why don't we end up with one that we still have? David Rovics.
It can happen in a moment. Sometimes it does when what could be is and what shouldn't be was. There are times when you gotta stand steady. There are other times when you gotta be ready. A window can open, seems so wide, but you can never tell when it's gonna slam shut. One day you're a target on the firing ranges. The next day all of a sudden, everything changes.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a replay of Michael Parenti's speech given in May of 2010 at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. He's talking about conspiracies. Michael Parenti is an internationally known, award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. And three of his most recent books that he's written are God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, A Michael Parenti Reader, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And here he is speaking at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz on May 15th, 2010.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm actually going to give a talk about deep ideology and conspiracy is really what I'm going to be talking about. And there's another talk I gave about a conspiracy. They just rediscovered it. It had been lost for some years, and they found the tape of it. Some student had actually taped it. It's not such bad shape, and it's available on TUC Radio, and that's called Conspiracy and Class Power. And that talk is probably more coherent and intelligent than this one will be because I was younger and more capable then. It's about 12 years old or so. I just heard it the other night. I said, hey, whoa, that's pretty good. And I thought I'd try to smuggle it in here. But, you know, it's better to really to think anew and think about some other things again. But what do I mean by deep ideology? Well, I mean I want to try and fit it into the theme of this conference. But it is questionable because ideology is usually something that is out there. It's vigorously propagated. You know, you talk of the conservative ideology has talked about the free market. They talked about how government can't solve the problem. Government is the problem. We're overregulated. We're overtaxed. There's a downward distribution to the less worthy. And now money is wasted by government bureaucrats and the like. But behind this explicit ideological cell, I just gave you a sketch of what the right-wing dicta are on that. Behind that explicit ideological cell is an implicit ideological goal and rationale. A rationale that's really around very real interests. In 1978, I came across a quote by somebody from the Business Council. His name wasn't given, but he was saying things like, what's going on? The income gap between the highest and lowest is more narrow than it's ever been. Human services are increasing. If we will end up as a social democracy if we don't watch it, he said. Now, I found that very fascinating because I think there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the hell social democracy means or even use the term. I mean, the term is simply not used in America, and that's a victory right there. The ability to keep certain words out of political discourse, like social democracy, is a very real right-wing victory. The ability to inject certain words like conspiracy theory, which puts a closure on any kind of thinking about something, that also is a tremendous victory. So this struggle, this battle over words is something to be taken very seriously. And if anybody asks me tomorrow on that panel, what will you do? I'll say struggle and battle over words. This was in 1978. 78, when this guy from the Business Council made that statement that we're heading for social democracy. What he meant is we're going to become another Denmark or Sweden or Norway where people will have health care, where the standard of living is going to be very good and high, where there's going to be a real pressure on the super rich, where CEOs will not be able to make hundreds of millions of dollars every year. They're going to have to get along on just a few million a year. You know, how the hell can a guy like that live on a few million a year? So they don't want that. And 78 was a very significant year because that Business Council delivered the word to President Jimmy Carter. And we got Reaganism, and we got Reagan 2 years before Reagan. He didn't come into office till January 81. And in 78, end of 78, Carter was acting like Reagan. He started cutting back on human services. He called for increase in the military budget. He was moving in a rightward direction. But Carter couldn't really do the thing that they wanted, which was a massive rollback. Carter was still beholden to the labor unions, to black voters, to progressives, liberals, and those people. And so they went with Reagan. Now, fast forward 30 years. You have had in that 30 years an ideological war that these guys have waged. They understand something that the liberals still don't understand. They understand something in the Republican Party that the Democrats still haven't been able to grasp, because the Democrats are too busy saying, we don't disagree that much. We really can work together. We can be bipartisan. They understand that ideas count, that ideology counts, that the words you use count, that those words control those ideas, and those ideas control those people. And they have been hammering home for those 30 years. So you go 30 years forward to the year 2008, and David Frum, GOP strategist, quote, the core task that the Republican Party has had was to stop and reverse to some degree the drift of democratic countries after the Second World War towards social democracy. And that is what we did in the U.S. We stopped the drift toward, and there's those two words that jumped right back up out of the page at me. It was in the New Yorker magazine. Social democracy. We got to stop the drift towards social democracy. These guys know about social democracy, and they know they have a conscious agenda to prevent it from happening. And they know that their opponents aren't even paying attention to this. The average Democratic politician, from Pat Leahy to Schumer to the others, with the possible exception of Howard Dean, who does know how to organize nationally and is totally ignored by the Democratic National Council, the others are all worrying about getting reelected themselves and putting in their little plea and talking about this or that issue. Well, what was Frum saying? He was saying, we've won the battle. We have so rolled back the social democracy that we've run out of issues. Furthermore, we've moved successfully so far right, we've moved beyond our base. And he noticed in the 2006 election, what? The Republicans lost Congress. And where did they lose Congress? They lost it in the goddamn Republican suburbs that always voted for them. Those people started waking up. Those people were saying, hey, they've been jacking us up the kazoo for all these years, and it's getting a little too bad. What are we getting out of this? I think I'm going to go back and start voting Democratic again. And domestic issues showed, and the polls showed, that the general public was on the liberal side of most of these issues. They were for human services. They were for keeping and developing Social Security. They were for health care and education and environmental protections and taxing the super rich. But as I said, the liberals never really mobilized that, never really built a narrative and a deep ideology and a public ideology around those issues, because some of these liberals are too busy not being liberals and being conservatives. Oh, we got a president who's like that. He's happiest when he can say, I'm for nuclear power, and we're going to drill offshore because America's going to be self-sustaining. Remember, he talked about he was a drill baby drill without the baby, but there he was. Those 40 years or so, the conservatives not only fashioned a mainline ideology, they built a net of media commentators, publications, networks, as I said, media networks, think tanks, professional and academic associations of their own, training centers that would channel and recruit and channel cadres of young conservative activists into law schools and from law schools into clerking for judgeships and the like, teachers, writers who promoted conservative ideas and policies. So there has been this structure of organizations that has orchestrated and propagated a mass line ideology that has been guided by a deep ideology, that is the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class. Sometimes it peeks through in the mass line ideology, when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism and progressive income tax is equated, and inheritance tax on the rich is equated with confiscation and communist theft, you know. The right over the last 40 years or more has been really pushing this line. Now, what I'm saying here is that this is a conscious, intentionally disguised agenda by people who know what social democracy is and say to you explicitly in English, your mother tongue, they say, we want to destroy social democracy. We don't want that in this country or any country. So they've got this, and they mobilize broad constituencies on behalf of the interests of the few. And that's the point to remember. A book I wrote on this called Democracy for the Few now just come out in its 9th edition. Don't buy it. It's horrible. They sell it as a textbook for $70, $80, despite protests of the author. That's not what the book was intended to be, a book only for royalty or oppressed students, you know. But for the few, you see, the very few at the top, and that's an idea that is at the heart of their raison d'être. That's an idea that they dare not utter to anybody. You'll never hear them saying that on the air. You'll never hear Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh saying, all of this is for the interests of the very super rich. Everything I do, everyone I serve is for that. Epauchi is what they were called in ancient Rome in the late Republic. And the term used quite often by one of them who was a member of the Epauchi. I wrote a book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar and dealt with this. They were called the Optimati. They were the inner core of the Roman Senate. The Roman Senate had 500 members, but there were these 15, 20, 30 who really, really owned much of Rome. And Epauchi was the term used by Cicero, who many people would consider one of them. He really wasn't. He didn't have the right blood, but he was their faithful servant and their faithful spokesperson. Pauci in Latin means few. He was saying, the few. This is for the few, you know. And sometimes he would be a little sarcastic about it and all. So we don't say epauchy. We say the super rich, the less than one half of 1% who really own most of the wealth. Now, whenever you ascribe conscious intent and pursuit of self-interest at the top, you will hear someone say, well, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? You can say farmers consciously organize to pursue their interests, and everybody will say, uh-huh, the farmers are organized. You can say machinists or auto workers are organizing, and everybody says, uh-huh. They're consciously organizing and pursuing, or school teachers or other people. But if you say that the people who own most of America and most of the world, if you say they consciously organize and pursue things to get what they want, then you hear people saying, oh, you have a conspiracy theory? You think they really do that? The alternative to a conspiracy theory is an innocence theory. That is, they do all this stuff, but they're not pursuing self-interest. They just do it, you know. The other alternative is a somnambulist theory. Somnambulism is the tendency to walk in your sleep. David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and he says, what am I going to do to advance my interests and protect my interests? No, that would be conspiratorial. Hey, well, that stuff happens, whatever. That's okay. Another alternative would be coincidence theory. It's just a coincidence that this happened. Or sometimes a variation of coincidence theory is uncanny theory. Then there's stupidity theory and incompetence theory. Don't laugh at that one. That's used all the time. I have had about a 20-year argument with my co-politicists on the left to stop calling Ronald Reagan stupid, to stop calling George Bush stupid. It's good for a joke or something, but that guy knew what he was doing, and he did it. He got rid of the inheritance tax for the super rich. He cut corporate taxes down to almost nothing. He doubled the military budget. He waged two major wars and got this country into war and left it that way. He deregulated, well, actually another creep before him named Bill Clinton deregulated the banking system and all that to create this disaster that we've been facing. These guys know what they're doing, And they know who they're doing it for. They're doing it for themselves. But they will actually even use, they'll even use this idea of incompetence theory to save their asses. When Reagan was on the line and brought before that court because of Iran-Contra, after Poindexter fell on the sword for him and said, oh, no, the president didn't know. Yeah, like they were going to do this whole scheme, these billions of dollars down to the Contras, conniving with Iran and all this. They're going to do this without telling the president, without clearing it with him. Cabinet-level people are going to just do this. Of course. And then Weinberger and all these others. It turns out Reagan knew all about it. Reagan was the guy who okayed it. And Reagan's defense was incompetence theory, saying, you know, I just really got to get a better grasp on what's going on here. I should be more hands-on. And everybody going, oh, Ronnie, what a dumb dodo. He didn't know. All right, he doesn't go to jail. All right. So then there's also stochastic theory. Stochasticism among intellectual academic circles, which is filled with people who have too much time on their hands. They make up words like stochasticism. It means everything happening by random. There's really no causality as such. So, you know, stuff just happens. So history is just these eventualities that just tumble down on top of each other like that. And stochasticism theory has a use. I mean, there are times when such things happen that you could have a very rational causality of people settling in a valley, let's say, because the land is fertile, the water is good and all that. And so you got one set of causalities, and then you have the mountain on the side, and that has a geological strata, and that has another set, and then one day the mountain comes down and crashes down and kills the people. The mountain didn't intend to kill the people. And that would be a stochastic happening where two eventualities quite accidentally collide and hit each other. So there is in history both causality and accident. We're not saying there aren't accidents at times, but is everything an accident when it comes from the top down? Well, the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class sometimes peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism. Oh, I already told you that. Let me go on. It's reached the point now on conspiracy where it has become one of those requisite genuflection renunciations hardened by convention. That is where you have to deny it. You have to disassociate yourself. You have to be saying something. Let me give you an analogy. It's very much like in the 1980s when you had the requisite genuflection was to make an anti-Soviet comment. I can think of leading progressive writers who could not criticize U.S. foreign policy without saying, and if we do that, we'll be as bad as the Soviets in Afghanistan. Every third paragraph or so, there had to be a sideswipe, and you had to flash a sign. And I would say to one or two of them, why don't you just wear a big sign saying, I am an anti-communist. That's fine. And then once you hold it up, we'll all agree. And you don't have to keep making these genuflections. I can remember a colleague of mine when I was back at a postdoctoral at Yale, doing this, or at Yale, the guy who's already, I said, Bill, you know, you got tenure. You got to keep flashing your anti-communist, anti-Soviet card. He was talking about policy in Africa and this and that. And there were all sorts of other things we could say. So that kind of hardened genuflection, it's a concept that is demonized and it's needed. Let me give you an example. Walter Karp, and it hurts me to take Walter because he was a wonderful guy. He's dead now. He wrote a book called Indispensable Enemies, 1974. He writes as follows. When it can be established, and he's writing about conspiracy, when it can be established that a number of political acts work in concert to produce a certain result, the presumption is strong that the actors were aiming at the result in question. Yes. When it can be shown, in addition, that the actors have an interest in producing these results, the presumptions become a fair certainty. And then he says, no conspiracy theory is required. You see, he has to disassociate. He's making a very intelligent conspiracy analysis, but he's got to disassociate and he's got to genuflect himself by saying, I'm not making a conspiracy theory here. No conspiracy theory is required. That's right. No conspiracy theory. A conspiracy analysis is being made. And you just made it I'll tell you more, he says, because it's really good. He says, on the other hand, those who make blanket condemnations of conspiracy theories base their own view on a far-fetched theory indeed, namely that whatever those in high office actually do, they are essentially men of goodwill. So you have those people who say there can't be such conspiracies because our leaders are people of goodwill. They have good intentions, and that's the way they are. I'll return to that point later. According to this school of special pleading, the king can do no wrong doctrine, suitably updated, it is entirely proper to praise an American president for skillfully engineering some desirable result. But to ascribe to him the same skillful engineering of an indefensible one is to fall victim to political paranoia and conspiratorial fetishism. I mean, that's not – Karp doesn't believe that. He's saying that's the way these people think, that when the president does something craftily and cleverly and succeeds and wins a victory, everybody says, oh, that was good political leadership. That's what that was. But if you say he would use craft and guile and skill to perpetrate unsavory ends like starting a war of aggression, then that's conspiracy theory that you're having. And there are these other two words. He mentioned one of the other two words. You see it in the press regularly. If they don't say you're suffering from conspiracy theory, they'll say you're being paranoid or you're being cynical. The cynical view, that's the other term that's sometimes used. So what we're facing, and not only from mainstream media and conventional academics, but even from among some leading progressive writers, we're facing a knee-jerk resistance to ascribing intent or covert actions and such by dismissing such ascriptions as conspiracy theory. So the term conspiracy theory is used to dismiss, one, the idea of a conscious design by policymakers. Two, a hidden but knowing intent. Three, a secret plan. Four, a secret interest. The term conspiracy theory is applied in two dimensions. The first dimension focuses on specific actions and events: an assassination, an act of terrorism, a mysterious disappearance of giant skyscrapers, a dirty deal in business, which is an illegal one. Or the second ascription is to dismiss an entire class interest, an entire social and ideological agenda. Rulers do not rule from secret intent. Do you get the difference? I mean, one is about specific actions and the other is about the whole system and structure. This explains why somebody, say, like Noam Chomsky, who does very good and very valuable work — this is not to take away anything from him in other areas, but I've had differences with him over the JFK assassination. Noam Chomsky, Alexander Coburn, Chip Berlet, they denounce this conspiracy theory, and they say if you're a radical, you don't go looking at these little hokey-pokey secret plots. Most of them imagined, even a few might be real, so what? Because there's the larger, bigger picture you got to look at. He's surprised, and they are surprised to find out, that they themselves are thought of as conspiracy theorists. There are people who think Noam Chomsky is a conspiracy theorist because of that second use of the term, that is, using it to mean a whole class power systemic intent that's directed toward certain kinds of forces. Behind the left rejection of the concept of conspiracy theory in academic circles is this structuralist functionalist debate that's gone on. Many of you have not heard about this structuralist functionalist debate over the years. You have every reason to be grateful that you haven't. It shows that you haven't been wasting your goddamn time on this issue. Well, the debate goes something like this. If you try to explain things through incidental or idiosyncratic analysis, this is very poor analysis, you know. If you try to say, well, the Spanish-American War happened because McKinley was all sort of scared and weak and Teddy Roosevelt was a real bombastic, and these personalities of the actors, and that brought the war on, or King Louis, who was it? King Louis says, no, it wouldn't be, King Louis says, gave aid to the American revolutionaries because, I forget, somebody killed his pet cat and he got angry at the guy and so forth and somebody, you know, little incidentalist stories like this or personalities and such, that is a very limited and dubious analysis of trying to explain historical phenomena. That the more impersonal and the more systemic, then the more radical. And the more systemic, the less volitional. The broader is the scope when you have a systemic analysis, and the deeper is the depth of your analysis, it is assumed. But what they're assuming here, you see, is a conflict between structural factors and functional factors, volitional factors, where people are consciously acting as actors with conscious intent. Because, in fact, the structure plays itself out through volitional forces. You have to have volitional forces. The CIA is itself neither. Is the CIA structuralist or is it functionalist? Functionalist, in other words, functionalist is discarded. Conspiracy theory is discarded as a form of functionalism. And Michael Abbott and Noam Chomsky had an article on that in Z Magazine. They call themselves structuralists, that they have structural. And I had a contract on a book I was writing at the time, Against Empire, with, what was that, the publishing house in Maine, the Common Courage. He didn't want to go on with the project. I canceled it with him, and I switched it over to City Lights as my publisher. And he said on the phone, this was after I had written that thing on JFK assassination, he said, well, you're a functionalist, and I'm a structuralist. You know, and I had other words for what he was and what I was, sounding something like structuralist and functionalist. And I'm saying, what is wrong with these guys? They suffer from in academia, academics are never happier than when they can choose up sides and they can dichotomize an issue. Well, you're a structuralist, I'm a functionalist, or you're a something otherist, and I'm a thisist, and then they choose up and they start fighting, and they have a little. You're a behavioralist, and I'm an intentionalist. You're a this and this, and I'm a thatalist. That's when they're really happy. And, of course, most of the time, these things aren't mutually exclusive. These functions play out. The CIA, as I started to say, the CIA is a structured conspiracy operation. You know, you could say, is the CIA a systemic agency that's part of a whole overriding class interest that must mobilize power in a certain way and does these things and operates that way? Or is it a bunch of conspirators who are doing that? And there are those of us who say, why can't it be both? Doesn't A and B, don't A and B serve each other perfectly well? But as I say, if you're so busy choosing up sides to keep yourself busy, they have too much time on their hands. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. Did you get that down? That's a direct quote from Michael Parenti. Okay. I should have read it more slowly. I see some of you were fumbling for pens. Oh, you want me to read it again? All right. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. I don't even know what that means, but that sounds like this.
You've just been listening to a speech by Michael Parenti at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the final part of that speech. You can also catch the video of the speech at the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
New York City held more slaves in the 18th century than any other city except for Charleston. It's no surprise that many of the buildings, streets, banks, and many of the other New York City landmarks carry the names of slave owners or slave supporters. Count Rikers Island City Jail among that batch.
Indeed. The island the jail sits on is named for Abraham Riker, or Abraham Ricken, a Dutch immigrant who acquired the land in the early 17th century and whose family owned it until selling it to the city in 1884. Abraham's descendant, Richard Riker, was infamous in the 1800s for supporting the Fugitive Slave Act to send or sell African Americans in New York to slave owners in the South. Well, this jail, Rikers Island, is the spider at the center of the web of New York's role in the slave trade. Its history threads through its present and supports the cry to shut it down. Now, highlights of the rally to shut Rikers down.
Rikers, Rikers!
Shut it down! Close Rikers!
Shut it down!
Shut it down, y'all!
Shut it down!
When you talk to the mayor about Rikers Island, he talks about the reforms that are happening. I've seen those reforms up close. They look like lipstick on a pig. I don't believe that you can reform this place. No! Who believes we could pour more money into it and get better outcomes in this place? I want to bring up, he's been an indispensable progressive leader in Queens for the past 20 years. He's worked tirelessly to reform biased police practices and end stop and frisk, Councilmember Danny Drum.
I've been to Rikers Island on at least 5 occasions. In fact, a friend of mine was locked up there. And even though my friend spent 130 days in solitary, came out, went to Fortune Society, tried to stay sober. When he picked up again and recommitted, was put back into solitary when he went on Rikers Island. I went and I visited Rikers Island. Rikers Island is a hellhole. Nobody should be in that hellhole. I saw with my own eyes where the man died and was put to death in his cell. I saw the paper that he had taped to the fan as it was blowing down in his bed, the filthy plastic that surrounded the bed, the urine smelling cell. I saw the graffiti walls. I saw the small windows where people were kept like animals. They're people, they're not animals. And so we fought very hard to try to begin the end of solitary confinement on Rikers Island. People were not listening until the feds really stepped in. Close Rikers! I'm proud to have been one of the first council members to say we must close Rikers. There's no other solution. So by you being out here today in force, by showing numbers and making our voices heard, we have begun the path down to justice. I continue to offer my support. Eventually, we will succeed.
Thank you, Councilman Danny Drum. Let me tell you a little bit of history about Rikers Island. Rikers Island is named after the Riken family. It's named after someone named Riken. He was a slave owner in New York. This island is named after a slave owner. And why is that relevant today? 89% of the people on Rikers are people of color. That ain't right!
That ain't right!
That ain't right!
That ain't right!
When I was 16 as a child, charged with shoplifting, I ended up here on Rikers with $1,500 bail. I was here for 2 days. The second day, on my way back to court, I got stabbed 4 times in a cell, 1 time in my neck, when the correction officer said to me, if you want a medic to help you, then you just won't go to court today. And then you also might end up being labeled a snitch. So you're telling me the thousands of people here on Rikers can't even do their time, the ones who don't even belong here, with their human dignity? And here it is decades later, and we hear the same stories emanating from this place every day.
It is not incarcerated. 89%
of the people at Rikers are people of color. 85% of people at Rikers are awaiting trial. 98% sexual assault that's not being reported. 79% of people waiting trial. $208,500 to lock people up. Close Rikers. Dignity for all. I want to bring up the peace poets. They've spent over a decade using spoken word, poetry, music, and theater to advance social change.
We say peace to the poets who propagate peace, and power to the people who march in these streets, and word to the workers who walk in bare feet, and light to the writers who fight to get free. I see me in you, and you in me, in the streets of Cochabamba, taking back El Agua, rocking Sandinista parties when we took Managua, shook my fist in Nueva York, yelling no a la guerra, environmentalist to protect la tierra, and I'm a feminist, porque respeto mi madre, soy padre y bebé, the struggle of every day, abuelita y hijito, soy la gente que grita, el pueblo unido, jamás será vencido. I'm the people united and I will never be divided. I'm the people who riot and I will never be quiet. I'm the one to rebel, stuck in a cell. I'm the people who see we are not yet free. Cause I am the people and the people are me. Peace.
The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated.
Colonialism made oppressors of the oppressed. Violence that left these lives tattered. DR and Haiti, it's a Black Lives Matter. Got me asking, where do Black Lives Matter? When just saying these words can leave your Black life splattered. To the people start to move like a black light dagger. Our revenge is to wake and act like it matters. Cause the truth is we're at a wake and our lives are at stake. So rumble my people, put food on your plate. Rumble my people, they'll tell you to wait. Rumble my people, our love is greater than hate. We face our history with dignity, need no man's pity. When our children's laughter is sweet like mangoes in the city. Thank you.
This is dedicated to all our political prisoners, and all our families behind bars, and for all our mothers, to all our mothers. We praise our mothers whom are holy, like Mamie Till Mobley. When it still feels like above corner and liquor stores, invisible signs read, for colored only. How much patience must we have for this emancipation procrastination? Where incarceration is a lot less about rehabilitation, but another stock option plantation. Raising families off of what drug deals yield. Some work the field, others pour rain to the house, leaving us with foot and mouth. Cause we got a black president, yet it's our history that Arizona and Texas bans. And even with the black Spider-Man, our babies are still getting killed over Skittles and Arizona cans. I can't seem to sober up these Miller men. America's intoxicated with racism from George Washington to George Zimmerman. And the history of cotton picking makes picking between two politicians, between a Trump and a Clinton, feel like picking between two nooses for lynching. There are days I still wake feeling like a second-class citizen. But we have survived over 400 years of slavery, dehumanized, cultural, physical, mental exploitation. It was illegal for us to read and write.
Now they kindly ask us to tone down what we recite. But if there's one thing that Langston taught us, it's that dreams deferred can never hide, that for only so long can truths be denied. We went from underground railroads while hounds sniffed for tracks. Went from Grand Wizard Theater dropping needles on the track to cracking the hood, heroin dropping needles, suture tracks, to condemning fatherless kids ill-equipped to pursue scholastic track, to 80s babies influenced by the boom bap. I swear if I lost my voice, I'd to get it back. With a twist of Bear Rustin, till I'm a James Baldwin type of lyricist, so throw your towel in the ring. Cause this is Muhammad Ali with a twist of Frederick Douglass and Rocksteady. Our ancestors drive us and guide us with a revolutionary love. We are the struggle of the Zapatista, the hope incited in Tunisia, and the driving out of Mubarak from Egypt. And though we've been occupied without our consent, we will decolonize minds 100%. And there's no need to ask you to prove your solidarity in a Facebook or Twitter caption, because true belief is best expressed in action.
I'd like to bring up an actor on Orange is the New Black, Emily Althaus.
I play a prisoner on TV, but we're not here today to talk about a TV show. We're here to talk about the very real circumstances of about 77,000 people per year that are admitted to Rikers, close to 85% of which have yet to be convicted of a crime. Unable to afford bail, they are held there, stripped of dignity and subpar conditions, and forced to participate in what is widely considered a culture of abuse. Because we know that our brothers, our sisters, husbands, sons, daughters, and fellow citizens deserve better. It's far too progressive to allow the cruel and inhumane conditions of Rikers Island to continue. It is no secret that this institution disproportionately affects people of color, specifically poor people of color. I view the closing of Rikers not only as a logical solution to a decades-old problem, but a necessary step towards humanity. A new civil rights movement is upon us. Every day we turn on the news, we are reminded of the state of our nation. We can decide which side of history to be on. And we must say, this is enough. It's enough. It's enough. Close Rikers. Shut it down.
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 I'd like to bring up the executive director of the College and Community Fellowship, someone who's dedicated to removing barriers to education for women who've been involved in the criminal justice system and their families, someone whose personal experience with the criminal justice system has informed her incredible decades-long participation and leadership in advancing social justice, Vivian Mixon.
I was in Nassau County Jail for more than a year as I fought my case before I went upstate. But while I was in there, I had an awakening that mass incarceration is not a solution to social problems. An awakening that mass incarceration is just a way to keep people of color under social control. An awakening that mass incarceration is just a way to discriminate against immigrants, against poor people, against the addicted, against the mentally ill, against the gender nonconforming. And I represent every woman that is on that island, every woman that is subject to abuse and violence and rape. A federal investigation has already proved that Rikers is a toxic cesspool of corruption and violence that puts at risk thousands of lives, all the way from Christopher Robinson to Khalif Browder to Judy Jean Cockreus and every other detainee or convicted human being on Rikers who suffered unwarranted brutality and criminal negligence. We know that it costs more than $200,000 to incarcerate one person on Rikers Island. Close Rikers!
Shut it down!
Shut it down, y'all!
Shut it down!
Shut it down!
The next person I'd like to bring up is on the new hit show, Designated Survivor. And most importantly, he spent time
mentoring young people on Rikers Island, Malik Yoba.
Oye, mi gente, ¿dónde estás? I said, listen, my people. What I know is also the result of who I know. Tony is a college student who last year was wrongfully pulled over for a DUI, which he was ultimately cleared for, but not before being detained for 31 days right behind me in this hellhole without seeing a judge. And so for 31 days, he would call and leave voice messages on his college professor's phone pleading, help me, I'm going to die. Fortunately, he's enrolled in the John Jay College Prison to College Pipeline program and has the support of loving and committed people like Dr. Boz Dreisinger. She wrote a book called Incarceration Nations, and they worked tirelessly to get him before a judge after 31 days. Khalif Brower wasn't so fortunate. He couldn't hold on to the hope of the healthy emotional and mental state as a 19-year-old after being detained for 3 years for a trial that didn't come for stealing a backpack. And once we're made aware of how truly shameful and inhumane and dangerous this place is, then we should all feel a bit of shame and turn that shame into action. So we come and we march and we sit to shut this place down. And if this place was successful at rehabilitating human beings, more than 50% of its occupants returned to. We know the numbers of black and brown people disproportionately represented here. We know there's a deeply ingrained belief system that somehow we all deserve to be here. And the what now is directly linked to the part of the legacy of slavery. The same conscious and unconscious biases that say we deserve to be gunned down mercilessly by the very people who were sworn to protect and serve us. It's cool to march, it's cool to protest, but in every single space that you occupy, then the question you must ask yourself every night that you go to bed is, what are you living for? God bless us all, and amen.
Malik Yoba said, shut it down. Rikers, 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 Rikers. And I'd like to bring up someone from the Arab American Association of New York. Abir Kawas is a youth organizer. She advocates on issues including immigration, police surveillance, and racial profiling.
All right. Assalamu alaikum, my brothers and sisters. I'm here today to call for the closing of Rikers Island. After 9/11, thousands of Muslims or people who looked like they were Muslim or identified as Muslim, they were surveilled, they were arrested, they were picked up by police, and they were picked up by immigration enforcement, many of them going through Rikers Island. My father was also placed in Rikers Island. I remember coming here when I was 9 years old, and Rikers Island was the first stop in a journey that took us through years of my father being detained, going through different jails in New York, in New Jersey, my father missing graduations and weddings and birthdays until his eventual deportation in 2009. I remember my mother coming here. We walked into Rikers Island. We waited online. We went through 3 security checks in the process. They were even more invasive towards my mother because she had on hijab at that time. The guards yelled at my mother because she didn't understand English really well. She was brutalized and yelled at, and I watched this all as a 9-year-old. Close down Rikers for us to invest in restorative justice. We need to especially separate the criminal legal system from the immigration system. When young immigrants get picked up for offenses like jumping the turnstile, their names get crossed with the databases of immigration and customs enforcement. They pick them up and deport them for small petty crimes. We need to stop dehumanizing prisoners. We need to talk about people like Khalif, who took his life at the thought of returning to this place. As a Muslim, I want to lastly just talk about one of my inspirations. His name is Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X. Malcolm X became politicized in the prison system. He said, "We declare our right on earth to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being by any means necessary." Yeah. From Brooklyn to Rikers to Baltimore to Charlotte to Standing Rock to Ayia Sinapa, from Ferguson to Palestine, we're standing together as a global community, and we're asking for the end of prisons. We're asking for freedom and justice, and we're asking to shut down Rikers.
The next person I'm bringing up, he's the safe reentry advocate on the mental health project at the Urban Justice Center. He was recently appointed to the New York State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Johnny Perez.
I served a total of 13 years in prison from the age of 21 all the way to the age of 34. I spent 3 years in solitary, and some of those years were also spent right here, right behind me. And a lot of times people say, "Well, Johnny, you're complaining. If you can't do the time, then you shouldn't do the crime." And then I say to them, "Well, you know, I partly agree. I mean, I did sell nickel bags of inhumanity, but how do you tell that to Khalees Browder's brother, to the brother of a young black boy who was shanghaied from the streets of New York City and accused of stealing a backpack that he didn't steal? Every day he was pulled out of his cell and slammed until eventually one day, 3 years later, they finally open up the cage and let him out. And he comes to realize that the only way for him to come to terms with what happened to him was to commit suicide. Say his name.
Khalees.
Say his name.
Khalees.
And it's important that we remember the name, because sometimes we forget the injustices that people go through. I also want to make sure that we remember the homeless, mentally ill veteran who, after serving his country, was arrested for trespassing only to be placed in a cell so hot that he literally baked to death. I don't know if maybe the fact that he was found in a pool of his own blood and vomit that bothered me the most, or that his mother, who's 75 years old, did not find out that Rikers had claimed her son's life until a month after his death. I remember buying drugs from a correction officer who then turned around and threatened to put me in a solitary if I didn't pay him on time. I remember going to the visiting floor and seeing the pain in my mother's eyes after she stood online for 6 hours when the correction officer said, "Excuse me, miss, you only have 20 minutes. You should have came earlier." I also remember crying. I remember the pain. I remember the agony. I remember not necessarily understanding what was going on at 16 years old. Lastly, you know, there's some people who, you know, they don't like when we march, right? They don't like when we say, "Close! Close!" They don't like when we say, "Rikers, Rikers!" I can't apologize. You can't criticize the reaction to our oppression from the seat and comfort of your privilege. Lastly, you know, there's some people who say that we can reform Rikers. They say that, you know, all we need to do is fix a few buildings and all that. What do y'all think about that? There's some conversations that say that maybe we should just change that. We can reform the island by doing something new, like introducing tasers or more cameras or more dogs, or maybe we should just introduce people in court with their jail uniforms on, as if it's not already hard enough to be a black man in today's society wearing my regular clothes. Imagine wearing handcuffs and a jail suit and saying, "Hey, I did not do the crime that I'm being accused for." See, we don't need more prisons. We need to invest in people before prisons. We don't need Rikers Island. What we need to do is put people inside of their communities. We'll be able to strengthen family ties and increase the likelihood of reentry. See, we should be trying to put families together and not break them up.
Thank you, Johnny. Akeem Browder is a leader in the movement against mass incarceration. He's the brother of Khalees Browder. He's a tireless advocate for closing Rikers Island and jails and prisons all over this country. He's the president of the campaign to shut down Rikers, Akeem Browder. Khalees represents a symbol of the torture that happens to our teens, our youth, and all of New York City that comes on this island. Wake up to reality that too many of our brothers, black and brown skin, are suffering on Rikers. But when are we going to stop saying, "Raise the age"? Raise the age. Where are we getting the correction that they say their names are? This is the Department of Corrections? Corruption. That's what they have. They dehumanize our brothers. They beat our brothers.
Right now, the campaign to shut down Rikers, what we do is we try to highlight the lives that's lost on Rikers, the lives that come out of here between 12 and 4 in the morning, at the way that life is after they say 3 years on Rikers. My brother didn't need to suffer. He didn't need to punish. Just like my brother that just came down, Johnny said that there's alternative ways. Guess what? Alternative ways looks like when you stop doing the things that happened in the past, because the only inhumane thing is to keep on thinking that we'll do the same thing over and over and expect difference. Money doesn't solve our problems. When it comes to getting a settlement, it's not going to bring Khalid back. It's not going to bring Eric Garner back. It's not going to bring any one of us back. Sandra Bland. It's not going to bring anyone back, but realistically, we need litigation. We need to bring it to court, bring them to get guilty. My mother, who's suffering right now, she's had a heart attack because of this. She's on her deathbed because of this. Why don't we stand up and say our tax dollars doesn't need to go to something like this? We live in the American dream that we can change. My brother's dream was to just be a kid. When he came home, he said, all I really wanted to do is still play Yu-Gi-Oh! Still play Dragon Ball. Where did his dream end? They took my brother as a 16-year-old, returned him as a man, with a young man, but a man nonetheless, because it forced him to speak way past his time. I'm here also with Paul Precia. He's our attorney since the beginning. Paul?
Thank you. About 2 years ago, I did this show with this gentleman, Glenn Martin, and the topic of closing Rikers Island came up. I kind of poo-pooed it at the time. I'm like, well, I don't know if that'll really ever happen, but you know what? It's about to happen. It needs to happen. And about that time, I was representing Khalif Browder when he was alive, and the reforms had begun, and they're still going. And this, along with Raise the Age, or this is the last reform, one of the last reforms left. This place must be closed down. And I'm so proud to see everybody here who support this cause and support Khalif Browder. What a great kid he was. And we will fight to keep his legacy alive for what he endured and what the change that he brought to our criminal justice system. And I know that it just might take a trial to expose the atrocities that happened to that young man in Rikers Island, to close this place down. And if that's what we have to do, then it will be done. Candy Alley, come up here, Candy. I just noticed you. I didn't even know you were going to be here. This is my client, Candy Haley. She's alive right now. Come up here. You don't know this story yet, because people find this stuff to be too old, or too depressing to hear, to listen to. Candy Haley. She was in solitary confinement at Rikers Island. Not for 1 year, not for 2 years. 3 years. 37 months in solitary confinement. 80 suicide attempts. I cannot begin to explain what, as a woman, she had to deal with. She had to live through modern day slavery, and that's an understatement.
Yes.
It's sad, it's sickening. She's still alive, and I'm making sure that she stays alive. And we will hear her story soon enough. Thank you, everybody.
Rikers, Rikers! Rikers, Rikers!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I grew up with a first cousin who's like my sister, who was born with cerebral palsy. And I said, Malini, what do you want for your birthday? And she said, I just want to have sex.
I think the problem with a lot of films on disability, especially in India, is that we tend to glorify the person, make them very angelic and sweet, whereas Laila is just another horny teenager.
In the South Asian gay rights movement, it was very uncomfortable when you're saying you're bisexual because it was like, well, that's really convenient. You're sitting on the fence.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Hong Kong puts diversity in the pink, hundreds detained for being proud in Kampala, and disability meets sexuality for a margarita with a straw. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 1st, 2016. More than 10,000 people were pretty in pink on September 25th at the third incarnation of Pink Dot Hong Kong, the city's LGBTI carnival. The annual celebration of diversity, equality, and love was held in its first 2 years at Tamer Park, but was relocated this year to the more pet-friendly West Kowloon Cultural District waterfront, organizers explained, to accommodate activities for everyone, young and old. Pink Dot Hong Kong enjoyed the support of a number of notable entertainers, celebrities, corporate sponsors, and diplomats, along with the chairperson of the city's Equal Opportunities Commission. The assembled pink-attired participants formed a huge human pink dot, providing some breathtaking aerial photos. Abby Lee was one of the organizers. Pink Dot represents the diversity of not only the LGBTI community, she said, but of our allies, friends, families, colleagues, and even our pets. Another organizer, Anthony Wong, noted that people are not afraid to step out and show they are members of the LGBTI community. And the most important thing, he added, is that more and more non-LGBTI people are willing to join us and show their support for equality and diversity. The first Pink Dot was held in Singapore in 2009. It spread to Hong Kong in 2014. Both events attract larger and larger crowds each year and help promote LGBTI rights across the region.
But Uganda's oxymoronically named ethics minister, Simon Lokodu, made good on his threat earlier in the week to arrest anyone who tried to hold an LGBT pride celebration in his country. Police shut down such an effort on September 24th that had attracted more than 100 people to a beach on Lake Victoria outside the Ugandan capital, Kampala, before the celebration could even begin. Leading Ugandan activist Frank Mugisha told reporters that most of the attendees were ordered into minibuses and escorted to a police station, apparently for questioning. One frightened young man jumped off a moving minibus on the way and was critically injured. Mugisha said that everyone on the bus was traumatized. All the detainees were later released without charge. Ugandan police disrupted a pride-related trans beauty pageant at a Kampala nightclub in August that also led to catch-and-release detentions. That raid prompted organizers to postpone further pride events until September, clearly with no better outcome. LGBT people, and those perceived to be, face official government hostility and entrenched societal homophobia in Uganda, enhanced by a number of far-right U.S. evangelicals who have made regular visits to the country peddling debunked Pray the Gay Away programs. Private, consensual, adult gay sex is illegal in the East African nation under a colonial-era law that already penalizes acts of gross indecency with lengthy prison terms. Proponents of a bill first introduced in 2009 to punish so-called aggravated homosexuality with execution continue to push a less severe but equally repressive version in Parliament. Uganda's highest court declared a 2014 version of the Anti-Homosexuality Act to be unconstitutional.
Masamate, a four-day film, art, and performance festival celebrating LGBT Afro-Caribbean culture, was scheduled to kick off on September 27th in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. But the entire event, organized by the country's leading LGBT advocacy group, Courage, was shut down by the government after organizers in the hosting venues were threatened with violence, including murderous attacks and arson. Masamate was launched in 2009 in Montreal and has also been successfully held in Brussels. This was to have been the first Masamate to be held in Haiti. Port-au-Prince Police Commissioner Jean Détant-Légère confirmed to reporters that he had issued the order to cancel the festival. He cited the need to protect public safety and Haiti's moral and social values. In a local broadcast interview, Légère also claimed to be acting on a complaint from several senators who charged that the queer Afro-Caribbean festival would be a provocation and a challenge to the traditional family model. Although there are no laws criminalizing same-gender sex in Haiti, the country's LGBT citizens remain largely underground because of government repression and social stigma. LGBT Haitians, or those perceived to be, are frequent victims of mob violence. At least two people died recently in murderous anti-queer assaults in Port-au-Prince.
The Times of India reported this week that hundreds of people were arrested last year for violating the country's colonial-era anti-gay Penal Code Section 377, which outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature. After sexual and gender minorities celebrated a lower court ruling declaring Section 377 to be unconstitutional, the nation's Supreme Court overturned that decision in 2013. The Times says that data from India's National Crime Records Bureau reveal that arrests have surged since then. There were 1,491 Section 377 arrests in 2015. Nearly all of those were men, though 207 minors and 16 women were among those arrested under the law. In 814 cases, the crimes were committed against children. The remaining crimes were committed by adults, but the report does not specify the number of times that the acts were not consensual. The law punishes violations of the statute with up to 10 years in prison. India's Supreme Court refused to hear a petition challenging the law in June. A final appeal to the High Court to reverse the decision, known as a curative petition, is pending. Defenders of the status quo have always insisted that the law can remain on the books because no one ever gets arrested under it. Despite the obvious contradiction, MPs and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's governing Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party have consistently rejected attempts to repeal the specific anti-gay provisions of the law while maintaining the penalties in Section 377 for sex with minors. A private member's bill to that end by an opposition National Congress Party MP lost by a vote of 58 to 14 in March.
In the latest HB2-related North Carolina news, some 60 major investment groups representing more than $2 trillion in managed assets joined several high-profile entertainers, professional and collegiate sports associations, and more than 200 businesses in calling for the U.S. state to repeal its discriminatory law. HB2 forbids local governments from passing ordinances banning anti-LGBT bias and requires trans people to use birth certificate-based public bathrooms. Matt Patsky, chief executive officer of Trillium Asset Management, said at a September 26 news conference that, without repeal, North Carolina is headed for a state government-inflected recession.
Officials in a number of other states and several cities have banned non-essential government travel to North Carolina to protest HB2. California, which boasts the world's sixth largest economy, has taken an additional step by also banning non-essential government-funded travel to Mississippi and other states with discriminatory anti-LGBT laws. State Assemblyman Evan Lowe wrote the legislation that was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown this week. All North Carolina travel bans have been issued by chief executives, such as governors or mayors. Assemblyman Lowe's measure makes California's the first state legislature in the U.S. to pass a law banning travel to all states that discriminate against gender and sexual minorities.
Meanwhile, the Board of Supervisors for the City and County of San Francisco took it even further on September 27th by voting unanimously to stop doing business with companies headquartered in states that specifically deny civil rights protection to LGBT people. The measure doesn't affect existing contracts with companies based in those states, but will likely prevent the city from renewing them. Bank of America is among the major companies that could be affected by the new ordinance. It was actually founded in San Francisco, but moved its headquarters to Charlotte, North Carolina in 1998 after merging with Nations Bank. Bank of America has an $8 million depository and payroll services contract with San Francisco that expires in August 2018.
And finally, Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore set some sort of judicial record this week by being suspended from office without pay for a second time. The 9-member Alabama Court of the Judiciary voted unanimously to remove him from the bench, this time for defying the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 civil marriage equality ruling by telling state probate judges to continue to deny marriage licenses to same-gender couples. The ethics panel removed the far-right Republican from office in 2003 because he refused a federal court order to tear down a Ten Commandments monument he'd installed at the state judicial building. Voters astonishingly re-elected him as Chief Justice in 2012 after he lost a race for the GOP gubernatorial nomination. Moore has repeatedly warned that opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples would destroy our country. One of his ardent supporters said his removal amounted to the persecution of a Christian official. The suspension by the ethics panel this week removes Moore for the rest of his current term, which was to run through 2018. Republican Governor Robert Bentley will appoint a replacement to fill out the rest of his term. Moore's judicial career is virtually over. State law forbids the now 69-year-old jurist from running for Chief Justice again because of his age.
Goodbye.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 1st, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jason Proctor.
And I'm Carol Myers.
You say goodbye.
On the Society page, love has again found Edie Windsor. Windsor is the lesbian widow whose inheritance rights lawsuit led to the U.S. Supreme Court's first decision against DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, in 2013. The now 87-year-old former plaintiff tied a new knot on September 26th, marrying 51-year-old investment banker and activist Judith Kaysen. Windsor said, "I was empty, and then this woman walked into my life. I didn't think it would happen again, and it did. She is it."
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
An unexpected coming-of-age story confronts disability in South Asian culture with a step beyond Bollywood and a leap for bi visibility. Correspondent Abby Dees spoke with two of the people behind the film.
Coming soon to a good art house theater near you, or maybe your DVD player, is the award-winning feature film Margarita with a Straw, about a young woman's coming of age and sexual discovery. I'm fortunate to be here with the film's writer and director, Shonali Bose, and its star, Kalki Kekla.
Correct.
Yay, I got it.
Thanks for getting my name right.
Shonali, people know you best for pretty unflinching work about social justice and political struggle. In this country, I think in particular, the feature film Amu, the story of a U.S.-raised Indian woman returning to India to discover her family's role in the 1984 massacre of thousands of Sikhs in Delhi after the assassination of Indira Gandhi. I was surprised when I saw this film because it seemed at first glance to be the opposite. It was a gentle coming-of-age story. Was that something that you wanted to do after that kind of experience, or how did this film come to life?
It's very deeply personal in that sense, you're right. Although I don't know if you've seen Amu, like Amu is also on a hardcore political issue, but it's completely buried in the film. Like it's a narrative drama that is not really like overtly political. So in this also, I feel there are issues of disability and sexuality, given that it's illegal to be gay in our country, that are so important and very as up there as genocide, I think. But again, it's about the narrative. Going beyond that, it was a very personal narrative for me because I grew up with a first cousin who's like my sister, just a year younger than me, who was born with cerebral palsy. And we were having this conversation. I was 40, she was 39. We were in a pub in London. She always outdrinks me. And I said, Malini, what do you want for your 40th birthday? It's the best birthday ever. And she said, I just want to have sex. And that was the inspiration, that thought that... Actually, when we were teenagers, I was very conscious that she was so romantic and was dying to have a date. And I thought about it a lot. And then I guess I didn't think about it anymore because I couldn't. I didn't know what to do about it. And I put it away because she was successful. She was studying in London. She wrote a novel. So I put that thought away saying it's okay, but it's not okay. It's not okay at all. It's a deep yearning that she has. And I'm sure many, many disabled people do. So that was the inspiration to write a story. And I thought it would be nice to do it as a coming of age of a teenager so that it feels universal, so that you cease to think of it as a disabled person's yearning, but as any teenager coming of age and falling in love and going through the ups and downs.
How do you describe the film for people who haven't seen it yet?
It's a coming of age love story, which is upbeat. And in India, our marketing, we were very conscious because we had a huge release in India and we always were like, this is like a Bollywood film. That was we were like, it's a happy love story, Bollywood film, you know.
Yeah, it's a rom-com.
She used to say it's a rom-com.
But it's got some really wonderful bittersweet elements to it. Mm. I mean, it's not just a prance.
No,
I really, really feel for the lead character, Lila, and you play Lila. Did you consult with your cousin when you were making the film, or was this sort of a surprise?
She read every single draft of the script, which I wrote 20 drafts or 30 drafts, I think. So she was involved right from the beginning. And Kalki will tell you more about this, but I introduced them very soon after I cast Kalki. I did that because I wanted her to experience and imbibe Malini's joie de vivre and understand how Malini saw in her own skin what she goes through. And that relationship, I think, was something very special for her.
What was it like, Kalki, to meet her?
Well, the first meeting was actually awful because Malini was feeling like a science experiment, I think. Because the first time we met, it was like asking her 100 questions about cerebral palsy and about her life and how she walks and how she talks and everything. And I think it was really tough the first time. And I was like, she was feeling very conscious.
She howled and howled. My father told me, who's her uncle, she howled and howled after that. And I felt just appalled. I've always grown up with her not thinking of her disability because that's how we've been brought up. And so just was insensitive in just asking certain technical specific questions. And
which I think if I wasn't there, would have been fine. But because it was a new person observing her, I think she got really conscious. So anyway, that first meeting was really tough. But after that, we kind of became friends on our own terms rather than through Shonali. I started hanging out with her, got drunk with her as Maldi loves to drink.
Does she like margaritas?
She's
more of a whiskey drinker.
Oh, okay.
I did margarita because I'm just a sweet, fluffy cocktail type of person, and she's like a hardcore drinker.
But she has a straw with it, you know. So I remember whiskey with a straw, and basically, like we hung out in her workplace. We hung out where she works in a center for disability. We hung out at home with her and out in public, and so I got to see her in these very, very different situations and how different things affect a person, especially in India with disability. We're so not used to seeing our disabled outside. There's still so much just from a basic infrastructural level that people don't go out much who are disabled. So when I went out to the theater with her, for example, like, you know, a lot of people just staring and also not being educated on what she had. So, you know, treating her, infantilizing her like she's a child, whereas, you know, she's been to Oxford, she's written a book. And
she's
a
pretty badass.
Person, yeah.
I read a little bit about her.
So all of that I really got to see close up. And she's also somebody who's got a great sense of humor. And I think that was really important in finding for Lila as well, that, you know, that she doesn't feel sorry for herself, that she does mess up and she's a normal person. Like, I think the problem with a lot of films on disability, especially in India, is that we tend to glorify the person, make them very angelic and sweet, whereas Lila is just another horny teenager with issues and problems and makes mistakes, you know. So that was really, really refreshing.
I was really conscious of that. I mean, there's a term for it. It's called inspiration porn. And I really was, because the whole thing is that the disabled have to be inspiring. And for me, creating a gray character was very important, because then it's a three-dimensional person who you identify with. So Lila is in no way perfect.
The film is very much focused on her sexual awakening. And I was quite aware that when I first saw in the film her sexuality coming onto screen, and it was not overt, it was not graphic or anything, it was very, very tastefully done and honest, I felt uncomfortable. And I was really bothered by the fact that I was uncomfortable, because I have stood up in public spaces and said, every woman has a right to claim and enjoy her sexuality. And by the end of the film, I'm happy to report that that discomfort had gone away. It kind of reminded me when I first started seeing same-sex sexual imagery in film, that same discomfort, it seemed so intimate because I wasn't used to seeing it. And I think that was just it. Were you aware that that would be a response that people would have? I don't think I'm alone.
No, leave alone the response, Abby. Like, I think you might be referring to the scene. It's the very first time we see her being sexual. She's actually masturbating. That is something we never see in cinema, leave alone a disabled person in a wheelchair masturbating, a woman masturbating.
Yeah.
And it was so tastefully done, as you said, because we were just on her back. For me, writing it and directing it, I felt uncomfortable, because it's an intimate space. I myself had an inhibition. I was felt inhibited to put it on screen. And I had to struggle with it, that should I keep it, should I not? Then thinking of my audience, because I myself was feeling that. But this is so important. It's sacred and important, and we've done it beautifully, and therefore I must keep it.
And it's true.
Yes.
I'm Edmund White. It is the overwhelming international flavor of the lesbian and gay rights movement that has proved so powerful over the past couple of decades. And one radio program has been there to record, to inform, and to entertain. So please keep listening to This Way Out on this station.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Shanali Bose, the writer and director of the independent film Margarita with a Straw, as well as the film's star, Kalki Kekla. Margarita with a Straw is available now on DVD and streaming on Netflix and Amazon Video. We've talked about the sexuality, but there's so many things in this film that we're not used to seeing. We're not used to seeing women's sexuality. We're still not, in that sort of honest, personal way, in a non-objectified way. We're not used to seeing the sexuality of the disabled. We're also not used to seeing images of bisexuality. And I know that in this country, they still cause comment. I'm wondering how these things were perceived in India.
I want to just talk about why I wrote it, though, before I get to the perception in India.
Because
the first 10 drafts of the script for the whole first year didn't have Lila being bisexual. Or in those first 10 drafts, Lila didn't even have sex with the man. It was just the masturbation, kissing, but not sex, because he had to take her to the bathroom. And when he did that, when they came back to making out, he couldn't. And that was a comment was told to me at the Sundance Lab, that why do you feel your character doesn't have sex? She never has sex in the film. And I was like, because my sister has never had the opportunity to have sex, and she's always been rejected because of her body, and I was being true to her story. And then they said, but, you know, there are others who have, and so you need to think about that. And also that he takes her to the bathroom and he gets turned off, and I'll never forget, she said, honey, that is such a sexy thing. He's taking her panties off.
Yeah,
it's sexy. Why would he get turned off? I was like, oh, my God, I have to really stretch my brain that he was. So... And I was like, yes, I was restricting myself to Malini, and I wasn't putting myself in the script or other things in the script. So for me as a writer, I always feel the most honest you can be is when you put yourself in all the characters, even the antagonists, even men, others who you are not, because you will then embody them with things that can come out from your own life. So I then started writing like that. But I was not conscious. I just had made that decision and I started writing in a deep way. And Lila and Khanum is a person who's blind in the film and is out and out gay person from Pakistan, actually. Came out to her parents when she was 14 in the script. She lives in New York and she's very comfortable with her sexuality and her disability. She's the inspirational character, I feel like, the empowered person. And Laila is still uncomfortable with both her sexuality and disability. So Khanum hits on Laila. And at this point, I'm writing the scene and Laila speaks to me as I'm writing, as a writer. And Laila is like, are you kidding me? This is a gorgeous, amazing person. Why won't I have sex with her? And I was like, oh, this is what you yearn for as a writer, that your characters speak to you. Laila is speaking to me. I've reached that nirvana where my character is speaking to me. And I wrote that. And then much later, of course, I understood. So when I myself was exactly the same age as Laila, I was 19. And my very first sexual experience was with a woman. In fact, she was at UC Berkeley and had come to India, Christian, and was so uncomfortable with it. Was from Berkeley campus, fully aware of sexuality and gay rights. I grew up in a very sort of sheltered, puritanical, innocent environment. I wasn't even aware of these things. I was 19. I had never had sex with anybody. And we fell in love. And it was so natural for me to be in a relationship with her and our lovemaking and everything. She was ashamed of it because it was against her Christianity. And she came back to America. She got married to a man. And I'm proud to say now she ended her marriage. She's with a woman, with her partner, and they have two children. And she's right out there in the gay rights movement. And I was like, don't forget an Indian, innocent Indian took you on that path. But it was my own. And after that, I remained an active bisexual. Like, I was married to a man, but I've also had other women. And so I feel like, for me, so when I came to the United States, then I came soon after. And at that time, at least in the South Asian gay rights movement, which I immediately was part of, it was very uncomfortable when you're saying you're bisexual, because it was like, well, that's really convenient. You're sitting on the fence. And I'm with my heart and soul, not because of me, like just to support the gay rights movement. Like I was just like, even if I'm straight, I'll say I'm gay, because I always felt left out that, well, I'm not really gay, but I couldn't pretend that. I was just like, well, I am bisexual. And that made me make that choice to make Laila bisexual versus just, I mean, could have made them both just gay, but I made one character gay and Laila, because I feel now we've moved on. It's now the B is there in the LGBTQ, so the B has been added there.
You described almost a little bit of a, well, why not? Laila doesn't have a problem. Laila's not confused. She's like, oh, that's what I am. I like sex. I like the person I'm with. Yeah, and that's it. There's something lovely about being able to just create that in a film, even if we're not always there in real life.
You know, just now I just came off of a festival in New York called Real Abilities, and this is the first time this happened to me, but it was shocking, where somebody from the audience just was angry and said, she's actually not bisexual. She's just dying to have sex, and she couldn't have it, and so she had sex with a woman, and she should not call herself bisexual. And I was blown away. I was like, wow, you can interpret it how you want, but I feel you're being judgmental. She feels she's bisexual. And if a person is saying what they are, it's their sexuality.
This is Abby Dees, and we've been talking about the new feature film Margarita with a Straw with writer and director Shonali Bose and the film star Kelki Keikla.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, Jason Proctor, and Abby Dees contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, like a generous anonymous donor from the WREK Atlanta area, all of whom helped make this program possible. Check out the latest show information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, KDUR Durango, Colorado, WRUV Burlington, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The socialist Orange Tawney once reflected that what thoughtful rich people call the problem of poverty, thoughtful poor people, with equal justice, call the problem of riches, which raises a pertinent question. Can the wealthy address the world's problems with their philanthropy, or are they part of the problem themselves? And what might the rich get in return for their tax-deductible donations? Sociologist Lindsay McGoy argues that charitable entities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation wield enormous influence on public policy, both domestically, such as in championing privately run charter schools and funding think tanks and journalists, and globally, in limiting the availability of crucial pharmaceuticals. And, she notes, they've received a free pass from the media. McGoy teaches at the University of Essex in the UK and is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy, which is published by Verso. Lindsay, almost half of the 85,000 foundations in the United States were started after the year 2000. What do you think accounts for this explosion of philanthropic entities?
People aren't really sure of a definitive answer. I think the sheer growth has actually taken even a lot of leading philanthropy experts by surprise. The number was hovering at about the 40,000 mark up until 2000. And then, as you say, yeah, from 2000 to 2015, the sheer number of foundations just exploded. And the number is now doubled. There's over 85,000 registered operating philanthropic foundations. And one of the reasons is that we're seeing a lot of greater wealth concentration, and a lot of very wealthy individuals want to place their money into a trust that they can oversee and that is able to dispense money over a number of years. So a lot of wealthy individuals are using philanthropic foundations as a vehicle for their philanthropic giving.
What are the, at least in the United States, what are the kind of restrictions that these foundations operate under, and what are the obvious benefits to those people who put their money into private foundations?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of important regulations that private foundations face. And if you have time, Sasha, in the interview, I'd like to maybe discuss, too, later on, that there's some new organizational entities which are emerging where people like Mark Zuckerberg are specifically choosing not to set up traditional private foundations, in part because they want to evade the regulatory restrictions that I'm going to talk about. So Zuckerberg's new philanthropic giving entity is a for-profit limited liability company, which is a whole different entity when it comes to the certain restrictions that I'll talk about facing more traditional foundations like the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. But essentially, foundations have been around for a long time, and they've gone through a number of changes over the decades. But they really got started in the early years of the turn of the 20th century. So in about 1914 to 1920, a number of foundations were endowed. And in the decades since, they faced an evolving list of different regulatory constraints and obligations placed on them that try to essentially make it a certainty that a certain amount of the money that's in an endowed foundation does get dispersed to people who need it. So essentially, some of the restrictions facing a traditional foundation would be that you can't place grants in institutions or recipient places that might financially benefit the founders of the philanthropic body. It's what's known as the self-dealing restriction. So it's a restraint on using your philanthropic investments to further your own private revenues, okay? So it's a restriction against private inurement or private benefiting from one's philanthropic disbursements. And then another regulation that these foundations face is that each year they have to have what's called a minimum payout, which means that they have to spend, at least in the U.S. case, at least 5% of their endowment each year towards various charitable causes of their own devising, okay? So that means that if you've got a body like the Gates Foundation, which is composed of actually two foundations, it's a bit complicated, but essentially in these two trusts, there's about, it hovers at the $40 billion mark each year, and it changes in line with some of its investments may be doing better on the stock market than others, but it's got all this money in its endowment, and each year it has to spend up to, well, at least 5% of that on various causes. And so that's why you see often the Gates Foundation will be spending up to $2 billion or $3 billion annually, because it's trying to make sure that it meets its legal obligation to spend at least 5% of its endowment each year.
In the course of the hour, I'm sure you'll talk about the benefits to those people who put their money into foundations in a broad sense, but just in a very narrow sense, what benefits do the wealthy get in putting their money into a philanthropic foundation?
Well, they get a tax break, in essence. It's not that they avoid all income tax, but they can offset some of the money that's invested in that endowment against their tax liabilities, okay? And so it can be anywhere from, it depends, about 20 to 30%. I hate to list specific percentages because the tax code is extremely confusing and complicated, but they do get certain tax privileges, tax exemptions, where they're able to use the money in that endowment in order to offset some of their tax liabilities. I mean, there's a tax benefit in that they can offset, just like any individuals who are giving to a charity, you can offset against that donation, against your overall income tax liabilities. People who place their money in foundations avoid paying the full extent of their income tax or tax on something like a cap.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the history of philanthropy in the United States, especially coming from the super rich historically, people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, who in their times were termed robber barons.
Well, one of the leading early influential industrial benefactor was Andrew Carnegie, who was initially born in Scotland but moved to the U.S. at the young age when he was still in his very early teens, made a fortune in the steel industry, and very early on, even while he was in his late 20s and early 30s, was very adamant that he planned to bequest his money to furthering the cause of humanity, to trying to improve the livelihoods of people living in both the United States as well as in Scotland, as well later on as people living throughout the world through his endowments towards world peace. He was very against military intervention and tried to put his money towards improving the pursuit of peace. But his money was always very controversial because while he was amassing his fortune, there's two areas where I think his policies were quite controversial. And I think because of that controversy, he's a good exemplar for us to turn to when we think of some of the paradoxes surrounding these major benefactors today and whether their money is rooted in moral ways of amassing wealth. The first reason why Carnegie is quite controversial is because he was very involved in using quite aggressive tactics to suppress labor uprisings at his factories. Although occasionally he paid lip service to the benefits of union organizing, in private he was very much focused on stamping out any union drives, any union organizing at his plants. So in 1889, he published this very famous essay, which was later retitled The Gospel of Wealth, where he argued that rich men have a duty to part with their fortunes because they have the skills and the expertise to oversee that money in a way that would ultimately benefit a larger community, but that the rich individuals, by virtue of their own business acumen, were better placed to understand the needs of a community than a community itself. So he essentially argued that it was okay for the wages of his laborers to remain at a fairly low level and for them to work very onerous hours against their efforts to restrict their own working days to a more reasonable level. So he was insistent that they should retain 12-hour shifts when 12-hour shifts could be incredibly backbreaking for people involved in manual labor. And he resisted their urge to try to reduce their hours to a reasonable level. He resisted their efforts to try to develop collective bargaining rights in order to press for higher wages. So he was a very, in essence, militant anti-union robber baron, and this is where he gets the nickname, he and other major industrialists at the end of the 19th century. They get this nickname, the robber barons, because working men essentially thought that they were stealing their own livelihoods away from them. They were stealing the wealth that should have been invested in the workers who were ultimately furthering the profits of people like Carnegie. That's one area. He was very virulently anti-union, even though it's not always recognized that that was his stance, because he was quite careful about it and he channeled some of his more vociferous, aggressive anti-union activities through some of his senior management, rather than making it seem like the decisions to suppress union activities were coming from him. He was quite careful about making it seem, for example, like one of his major stewards, a man named Henry Clay Frick, he sort of made it seem like Frick was the one who was calling in the national militia to suppress unionists, calling in the Pinkerton Detective Agency. So there were very bloody battles going on at a number of Carnegie's plants, and Carnegie sort of took care to make it seem like he was absent from the front lines, like he was not overseeing the effort to suppress the union efforts, but actually historians have clearly shown that he was centrally involved in the anti-union efforts. The other reason which I think is quite important to remember where some of the wealth of these major industrialists came from is that Carnegie was constantly lobbying for very, very favorable tariffs on steel imports coming from outside the United States. So in many ways, his wealth could be attributed to national policies that were implemented by mostly Republican governments, and Carnegie was a staunch Republican, that really were opposed to free trade. So he was very much in favor of a protectionist policy that mostly benefited people who were already capital owners. And people pushing for more free trade at that time were actually more Democrats, who thought that if you could open up global competition, you could actually get to a position where the price of commodities might be lowered, where you've got a more fair economic system. And Carnegie, while his fortune was being amassed, was very anti-free trade. And it was only after the U.S. steel industry reached a place of global competitiveness that he later sort of did a days, he changed his mind and insisted that free trade was the way to go. So he was quite hypocritical.
That's the voice of Lindsay McGoy. She is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How does the philanthropy of today, sometimes labeled philanthrocapitalism, differ from that of robber barons like Andrew Carnegie?
We're seeing huge changes. We're seeing the philanthropic landscape shift almost unfathomably over the past 10 to 16 years, changes that have really coincided with the emergence of very large benefactors like the Gates Foundation. So let's talk about this new shift, philanthrocapitalism. It's not a term that I like personally. I'm not a fan of the term, but I think it's a good phrase to get us thinking about some of the new developments in philanthropy, which have really been, the new trends have been an emergence of what proponents call a shift towards for-profit philanthropy. Another change has been the rise in direct grants to corporations like MasterCard, which are increasingly receiving non-repayable gifts from bodies like the Gates Foundation that they never have to pay back, regardless of how profitable those gifts become for the corporations. So it's been such a wind shift and change that it's hard to encapsulate all the developments. But
can you just explain what you just touched on? What do you mean that an entity like the Gates Foundation gives these finance companies this kind of money?
It's hard to almost understand or to explain, but that's exactly what's happening. Gates Foundation gave MasterCard $11 million to set up a lab for financial inclusion in Nairobi, in Kenya. So let's stand back and talk about why they did this, why they gave this money. Well, they claim that MasterCard is a well-placed entity to foster new forms of financial inclusion in a developing region like Kenya, okay? They say that what's happening in places like Kenya is that the poor don't have enough access to financial credit, and this is a way to help improve the livelihoods of the poor in places like Nairobi, in Kenya, and so they are positioning companies like MasterCard to be able to supposedly provide more access to credit. Now, this might be plausible. There's no necessary objection to the idea that the poor do need better access to credit. That's a reality. My question is whether an extremely lucrative company like MasterCard, which operates in a not an entirely monopolistic fashion because there are other large major credit providers, credit companies like Visa, but I really question whether the monopolistic policy of enriching these already wealthy companies to expand into developing regions is a feasible model for charity, especially when, in essence, MasterCard has had incredible profitability over the past 5 to 10 years. It pays its executives $5-6 million salaries. And rather than try to have an internal rethinking of its own use of its own dividends by saying to itself, we will assume our own risk for rolling out our operations in Nairobi, because MasterCard has made it very clear that this is in some ways a business strategy for them, that it's financially useful and can be profitable to engage in developing regions, but that it's also a risky proposition. And so they have been on record praising the Gates Foundation for helping them to avoid some of the risk of expansion in a new market. Well, I think that's perhaps arguable, but I think that's not capitalism. That's just cronyism in a way. It's using a philanthropic body to offset the risk, the financial risk for expanding in a new area. And essentially, Gates Foundation is simply helping MasterCard to improve its own bottom line. And the Gates Foundation is calling this a charitable venture because the Gates Foundation argues that this gift to MasterCard is in line with its own charitable aim to improve what they call financial inclusion in poor nations. But I argue that actually, and I've been on record saying this, I think this is questionable legally, and I think this might skirt certain 501c3 regulations which tried to inhibit private profiteering from a charitable grant.
Now, would this fall under the term that you mentioned a few minutes ago, for-profit philanthropy, which, you know, sounds like a contradiction in terms?
It would. This term, philanthrocapitalism, I haven't seen the Gates Foundation get behind it. They don't themselves espouse the term philanthrocapitalism. The term was coined by a person named Matthew Bishop, who's an editor at The Economist magazine, back in 2006. And he's the one who argues that we are seeing this new merging of the for-profit and the nonprofit sector in a really radical and revolutionary way that's set to unleash untold benefits for developing regions and for poor individuals living in wealthy nations. I think we are seeing a blurring of the boundaries between nonprofit entities and for-profit ones. Where I debate someone like Bishop is whether the benefits are necessarily clear for the most impoverished people living in these regions, or whether we're simply seeing a rise of something that I describe as the rise of rich-to-rich giving, where we're simply seeing places like the Gates Foundation, because they ultimately trust large corporations, they do think economic growth is sort of a good in its own right. They're willing to suggest that any economic expansion is beneficial in itself, and that's why they turn to a place like MasterCard, because they think a for-profit company might be, say, more risk-taking, more entrepreneurial. I'm not sure exactly what their defense is, because it's very hard to get the Gates Foundation to comment on things which one might be critical about. All I know is that when I asked them about the gift to MasterCard, they claimed that it was in line with their own charitable mission and therefore in line with IRS regulations, which do permit gifts to for-profit entities, but those gifts are meant to be used solely for charitable purposes. Now, that word solely is the key word, because I think it's clear that the gift to MasterCard is not being used solely. It's not being used only for charitable purposes. It's also being used for quite clear corporate expansion efforts. It's quite clearly aimed at increasing MasterCard's revenues.
Let's turn and talk about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is the focus of a sizable chunk of your book. They are the most powerful philanthropic charity in the world. Can you just start by giving us a sense of the scale of their influence?
They've played a huge role in shifting the education landscape in the United States, and they've also been extremely influential on the world scale. And I mean, I don't debate the fact that occasionally they've certainly done some good. They've increased awareness of the need to invest in global health, and I think that's a good development. I think because the Gates Foundation has been playing a strong role in trying to insist on the value of putting government money into global health, we're seeing in some ways a multiplier effect where certainly there's more money going towards battling both communicable diseases like malaria or tuberculosis, as well as more recently, money going towards fighting chronic diseases, which increasingly account for the majority of preventable deaths, not simply in rich nations like the U.S. or the United Kingdom, but also in poor nations. But I think where you can maybe see their influence having a controversial effect is when it comes to schooling in the United States. And I'm sure there in California, this is something that you hear about a bit, indeed, where they're being quite influential on driving certain education policies.
Sure. So tell us about the orientation that the Gates Foundation has had in alliance with other foundations in trying to shape, and successfully shaping, elementary and secondary school education in the United States. What form has it taken?
Well, there's been three foundation players when it's come to education in the United States, and they are the Walton Family Trust, the Gates Foundation, and the Broad Foundation, which is set up by Eli Broad. And these three foundations together have essentially used targeted grants to lobby, although they wouldn't use a term like lobbying because that's traditionally prohibited by IRS regulations, but certainly they might favor a word like advocacy, where there's a little bit more legislative leeway And they've essentially been instrumental in a number of different developments. The charter school expansion has been something that's been essentially, to a large degree, bankrolled by these foundations who are, I think, not necessarily positioning themselves to enable, say, a founder like Bill Gates to profit from his philanthropy. I don't think that's what he's trying to do. I genuinely think he is quite well-meaning when it comes to his own philanthropic efforts, and he is not trying to profit himself. But he's been very sanguine, very sort of complacent about the idea that allowing for a degree of profiting from the public education space is not necessarily a negative thing. So a lot of charter schools do operate on a for-profit basis in the United States, and that is extremely unusual in comparison to other nations. There's in the UK, certainly, although we have a very right-leaning government and since the Thatcher years onwards, you've seen a lot of privatization of social services and a lot of profit capacity being built into public sector funding. Certainly, the public school system has been a realm that's managed to withstand this privatization turn, and that's got a where profiting from essentially the provision of education to children at the elementary and secondary school level is prohibited. So the U.S. is quite an outlier in its willingness to allow private profiting from charter schools. And the big concern with them is that they lack the oversight of a traditional public school, and that tax dollars are being increasingly used to fund very, very exorbitant salaries and profits for the owners of different charter school franchises in a way that's not necessarily justifiable when it comes to student outcomes. So essentially, these wealthy charter school operator owners are getting value for nothing. They're using tax dollars, so they're not assuming much risk, and they're able to profit from the provision of substandard schooling. And the Gates Foundation, by essentially putting a lot of money into grassroots groups that lobby for charter school expansion, has really been at the forefront of the charter school turn. Another controversial area, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in California and, of course, throughout the United States, has been this drive towards pay-for-performance teaching. Mm-hmm. So the Gates Foundation was at the forefront of trying to introduce certainly a lot more standardized testing. And although they weren't the pioneers of what's called value-added measures, they certainly put a lot of money into it. And this value-added testing, value-added approaches to education are where you try to isolate the effect that a teacher has had on the outcome of a child's education. And this is something that's traditionally been very hard to do because, and it still is hard to do, and that's because it's very, very hard to disaggregate what the effect of a teacher has been when so many other external factors, such as poverty, a parent's level of education, things like malnutrition, things like access to shelter. There's huge and growing homeless problems in the United States. And all these things can affect how well a child does at school. The Gates Foundation was initially at the forefront of people who said, well, we know that those things matter. We're not denying that. But we feel that where our money can really help is on the teacher's performance itself and trying to improve that. And so we're going to introduce these new value-added standardized testing measures that try to essentially isolate out the teacher's effect. And that's been very, very controversial because it's very hard to do and it leads to a lot of unintended effects where a lot of teachers are penalized for essentially what has been shown to be faulty statistical measures. Most recently, the Gates Foundation has done something of a public mea culpa. They've said, we were wrong, we were wrong, we were wrong. We were wrong about these efforts to really isolate the teacher's effectiveness, and we're backing away from our push to roll out value-added testing mechanisms across the nation. So in some ways, I admire the way they're willing to say we were wrong. The problem is, unless they back away from a decision, there's very few cases where the Gates Foundation has responded to a lot of longstanding criticism of its activities, and there's absolutely no democratic way to essentially make sure that they are responsive to communities who their philanthropy does affect, sometimes negatively. And unlike an elected official or an elected party, there's no mechanism for ensuring a democratic necessity to respond to a constituency.
Lindsay McGoy is my guest. We'll return with her in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the price of philanthropy. I'm speaking with the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, and that's published by Verso. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. Lindsay McGoy is senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Essex. You were speaking a moment ago about one of the major problems with philanthropic entities and the very wealthy people who fund them having the kind of power that they do to shape public policy, because, as you say, there are no way to hold them accountable, unlike, at least in theory, people in government. One area where the Gates Foundation has had a large impact has been around global health. And I wonder if you could talk about what has been problematic in their intervention there, much celebrated, that they were putting their money towards health, which is obviously vastly underfunded. Why are you concerned about that dimension of the Gates Foundation's work?
I think some of the negative implications are less clear in the global health realm. And certainly, I think there are some initiatives which the Gates Foundation has been supportive of, which are beneficial, such as, for example, a lot of funding towards Gavi, which is the Vaccine Alliance. And I do think that an increased access to different vaccines internationally is a positive development. There's two things to talk about when it comes to the Gates Foundation and health. One is that you say that health is underfunded, and that is the case, that global health started to be in some ways less of a priority area around the mid-90s, and that's been almost completely revolutionized by a few new players getting involved and insisting that governments need to invest in global health. But no matter that it was traditionally a bit less funded, it is still the case that what the Gates Foundation puts towards global health is simply a drop in the bucket compared to what government actors spend. The overseas development assistance that the U.S. government contributes to aid generally, but also global health initiatives, it's just in the multi-billions, and it dwarfs the amount that the Gates Foundation offers. So one of my big aims in the book was to point out that we often hear statistics such as Gates Foundation is saving countless malaria lives, saving countless lives by preventing malaria deaths, or Gates Foundation has played a central role in improving levels of maternal mortality worldwide. Now, it's true that we're seeing a drop in global maternal mortality internationally. One of the outliers on that is actually the U.S., which has a quite high maternal mortality rate in comparison to other wealthy nations,
right,
and is really lagging behind this general global trend. But the positive is that internationally you are seeing gains when it comes to improvements in maternal mortality. Now, on a pure dollar basis, that achievement, that gain, is really attributable to both developing countries making headway in their own commitments to their populaces, as well as the huge amount that's invested by governments in providing health aid. So just on a sheer dollar basis, what the Gates Foundation offers It's simply a drop in the bucket. It's negligible compared to what wealthy nations cumulatively put towards global health initiatives. So I get a little frustrated when I sense that the Gates Foundation is, in essence, punching above its weight. It's getting a lot of reputational capital, and it's actually perpetuating, I think, something that's dangerously false, which is the idea that governments are doing nothing when it comes to health commitments, or that lone entrepreneurs are somehow uniquely responsible for these huge gains that we see in health rises or health gains across the world. And so I, in some ways, wanted to point out a corrective to this new mythology we're seeing arising surrounding this perception that it's lone entrepreneurs somehow saving the world, when on a dollar basis, it's just simply not the case. What the Gates Foundation puts towards global health doesn't even compare remotely to what different health bodies like the World Bank spend or bodies like the U.S. government.
Well, bearing that in mind, bearing that the kudos that the Gates Foundation receives may be outsized compared to their actual contributions. Bearing that in mind, what has been the impact of the Gates Foundation's stance on patent protection and pharmaceuticals in terms of its real-world implications?
This is, I would say, the main concern with the Gates Foundation's global health activities. Essentially, it's very hard to understand or to get a clear statement from the Gates Foundation on what its approach to patent protections is. So just to give a quick overview, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will already be familiar with some of these challenges surrounding access to medicines, but a lot of policymakers, a lot of developing nations, a lot of non-governmental organizations, such as Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, which is have taken a lead role in trying to point out that currently the protections that are in place to allow pharmaceutical companies to benefit from their own patented technologies, well, a certain degree of patent protection is necessary to essentially reward risk-taking. People say, and I agree very strongly with this, that the entire system for protecting the patent rights of large, often U.S.-based multinationals is really, really, really strongly militates against the effort to procure access to affordable medicines in developing countries. We've seen this time and time again. The main paradigmatic case that is still upheld as a reason why you often need legislation in place that permits companies to produce drugs at a cheaper rate than they might be if they're fully reliant on patented medicines is the HIV sort of pandemic across the world, and particularly in South Africa back in 2001. You saw the South African government taken to court by a consortium of pharmaceutical manufacturers who were opposed to the South African government's effort to try to essentially use its own domestic laws to commission the manufacture and the import of cheap generic medicines, which could lower the treatment of an average HIV sufferer, in essence, from about $12,000 per head to less than $10 per person. So we had the technology in place to vastly lower the cost of getting HIV medicines, antiretroviral medicines, to infected individuals. But this effort was countered by a consortium of pharmaceutical manufacturers, including major players like GlaxoSmithKline, who essentially were suing the South African government for taking this preventative, or not simply preventative, this simply treatment active plan to try to reduce the health burden that its own citizens were facing. And when this happened, eventually the pharmaceutical manufacturers dropped their suit. They lost the battle. And this led to a lot of efforts to try to improve the international legislation that governs access to medicines. And it's governed by the World Trade Organization. And since 2001, a lot of gains have been made in trying to develop more mechanisms to obtain better access to medicines. But we're certainly still a long, long, long way off from where a lot of international health activists would like to see us be, when it comes to essentially deterring the U.S. government from bullying smaller countries when they want to import medicines cheaply, because certainly that's what the government, the U.S. government does do quite often. And the concern is that Mr. Gates himself has never once spoken in favor of the health activists' efforts to improve access to medicines. And not only has he not spoken in favor of their efforts to improve patent restrictions, he has been very vocal in supporting the current international patent system and suggesting that it is no barrier to access to affordable medicines in poor nations. I think that he is simply on that stance of his. I think it's an ideologically driven stance. I think it's one that certainly he was strongly in favor of patent protections when he was involved at Microsoft. He was certainly been in favor of increasing patent protections in a way that I think is contrary to the Gates Foundation's global health mission.
Well, let me ask you about the role of the Gates Foundation in Africa, particularly to do with agriculture.
I focused in my book more on the education landscape and health, and I only touched briefly in one chapter on its efforts with agriculture. So I don't think I am necessarily the best expert to talk about some of its work in this area with a great deal of specificity. I can only give you the broad strokes. And I do think that they are evolving their stance when it comes to agriculture, so it's important to check back regularly with where they're placing their endowments, with whether they're shifting their position on certain approaches, because I think they, particularly when it comes to agriculture, have tried to be open to the concerns over some of their past practices. So you might hear, for example, that the Gates Foundation is invested in Monsanto. That's no longer the case anymore. They did hold shares in the past, but they have divested from their Monsanto shares. And equally, they've divested from other problematic corporations that I think their strong position and hold in really undermined their global health mission. So, for example, they had a 7% of their endowment was invested in McDonald's at one stage, and 9% of their whole endowment was invested in Coca-Cola. And I think most problematically, a lot of the Gates Foundation money actually comes from its shares in its gift from Warren Buffett's shares in Berkshire Hathaway. So at least half of the Gates Foundation's endowment does, well, not actually half currently, but once Mr. Buffett's pledge to gift $30 billion worth of Berkshire Hathaway pledges shares is fully offered to the Gates Foundation, which is a gift that's taking place in incremental stages, at some stage half the endowment might be composed of Mr. Buffett's company and not Mr. Gates's. But they did divest from Monsanto. They eventually shed almost all their shares in Coca-Cola and McDonald's, which are welcome developments, I think, because at one stage, the Gates Foundation was poised to be the largest shareholder of Coca-Cola in the world. And I think that's a problematic tension when you have a body that's as publicly committed to improving public health as the Gates Foundation, for it to be so strongly involved or invested in Coca-Cola was one of the main reasons why I wanted to write my book, to talk about that tension and to say, well, we know that Coca-Cola is involved in some problematic marketing tactics. We know that it was funding scientists based at Harvard and elsewhere to try to deny the possibility that sugary drinks could lead to obesity problems. So we know that the Coca-Cola was involved in some very problematic efforts to undermine the science of obesity research, and yet at the same time you have a body like the Gates Foundation strongly partnering with Coca-Cola and investing a lot of its endowment in this company. But they got out of Coca-Cola, they got out of Monsanto, but what they haven't done is stepped away from the position that they argue Monsanto should play a strong role in improving agricultural processes in countries in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. And why I think that's problematic is whether you're a believer in genetically modified organisms or not, whether you believe in GMOs, and I personally am agnostic about their benefits because I simply don't think we know enough about it, partly because a lot of the science has been commercially protected and there's prohibitions against independent researchers testing many of the products. But regardless of whether you're a fan of GMOs or not, my main concern was more the economic model of improving Monsanto's almost monopolistic position in regions of sub-Saharan Africa, when a lot of African voices were saying this is stifling competition, this is preventing us from being able to improve small holdings, this is preventing farmers from re-harvesting seeds. They have to always procure more and more seeds from Monsanto or face major legal challenges. So I think the Gezo Nation is slightly blind, frankly, to some of the negative effects of monopolistic competition when it comes to economic growth. And this is my main concern with their tendency to be what I call corporate populists. They are strongly in favor of corporate solutions to some of the world's strongest health and agriculture limitations, and I don't always think that a corporate involvement in these realms is a good idea, especially when markets are in their infancy, and we need to let smaller countries catch up.
Lindsay McGoy is my guest. She is the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy, that's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. One of the things that you write in your book, No Such Thing as a Free Gift, is that you were motivated to write about the Gates Foundation partially because, despite their enormous size, there has been little critical attention paid to their actions. Certainly in the media you can find all sorts of accolades, sometimes every day, but in terms of critical inquiry, there's not very much. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I would love an answer to that, a firm answer. I think that a lot of its money is put towards causes that you or I or anyone would agree with. We all hope to see children educated in an equitable way. That means people from poor families or rich ones have an equal shot at a sound and robust and comprehensive education. And this is what the Gates Foundation maintains its mission is about. As they say publicly, their view is that all lives have equal value. And I think that's not simply a palatable mission statement, it's almost a sacred one. And I think that process of almost sanctifying the moral position they are coming from makes it incredibly hard for people to criticize any of the process of their philanthropic expenditures or the effects, because it means that people feel as if they are criticizing what is most special and laudable and admirable about any of us, which is our desire to try to be, if we can, selfless individuals. And so the sheer amount of the Gates Foundation's giving makes Mr. Gates and Mrs. Gates seem almost saintly in their approach, which is something that my colleague Darren Thiel and I write about, because as sociologists, we're really interested in the moral implications that underpin different activities. But my fear is that that desire not to criticize a morally blameless stance means that a lot of power is invested in a small group of individuals, and the goal of the Gates Foundation to improve equality is actually undermined through their own tendency to gift large gifts to other corporations, to arguably, but I think quite plausibly, you can make an argument they are undermining democratic institutions when they have such a strong influence on education policy that Mr. Gates can be sort of jokingly in a way that resonates with a lot of people, referred to as the shadow minister of education in the United States. You know that this individual has a lot of power. And my concern is that even though their aims are laudable, their very philanthropic choices might be undermining the very goals that they're trying to achieve.
What about philanthropic foundations' influence on the media? I'm not just speaking of the Gates Foundation, but in the United States, much of public broadcasting, for example, is underwritten by charitable foundations as well as for-profit companies. Do you think that's led in any way to less scrutiny of the role of private foundations, philanthropic entities, in their role, their outsized role in the last decades?
When it comes to their influence on media, I'll say bluntly, I think you hear this a lot, and it can be a a knee-jerk reaction to say the mainstream media is asleep at the wheel. I think quite clearly when it comes to essentially the fawning way that any announcement by any of these new philanthropists, not just the Gateses, but increasingly people like Mark Zuckerberg, whose recent pronouncements that 3 billion will end disease by the end of 2100, it's actually a slightly ludicrous claim, because what $3 billion amounts to is less than 1% of what the U.S. government will invest on basic health research over the next 10 years. So these patently quite obvious, ludicrous claims emanating from people like Mr. Zuckerberg are not being treated with the skepticism and the due diligence that they deserve by either media groups, and also I'd like to see different legislative bodies taking more of an interest into whether or not 501c3 regulations are really being adhered to as strongly as they should be.
That, of course, being the tax code for nonprofit entities.
That's right. And the interesting thing with Mr. Zuckerberg's new entity is that it's not, of course, subject to those same tax provisions, because it is a for-profit limited liability company. So it's not actually a charity at all. And yes, it doesn't have some of the same tax benefits of a charity, but also Mr. Zuckerberg himself certainly does assume a lot of income tax benefits by shifting shares in Facebook to this new limited liability company. And despite those strong tax exemptions, we'll know a lot less about his entity than we do about the Gates Foundation, because whether you like the Gates Foundation or not, at least I think you have to commend the fact that they're quite public about where all their money is going. Legally, they have to be, so they're just following the legal rules there. But they make their grants really easy to access and to search through, whereas donors like the Koch brothers, I mean, trying to really scrutinize where their grants are going is possible, but a lot less easy than with the Gates Foundation. But when it comes to Mr. Zuckerberg's new entity, as a limited liability company, it does not face the same onus to disclose every investment or grant it makes to the public. So we may never know where all its money is going. It could all be legally going to for-profit recipients, and we'll never know.
We are entirely out of time. Lindsay McGoy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sasha. Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy. That's published by Verso Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Essex. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.